This is the September 14th, 2022 meeting of the Water Resources and Watershed Committee of the South Carita Valley Water Agency's Board of Directors. This meeting is being conducted in person at the Engineering Services Section Boardroom as a convenience to the public. Members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the agency's Zoom meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the committee using the call-in number or the Zoom webinar link. In the event that there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in option or internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. Reminder to staff who are presenting online, please mute all your devices until you're ready to speak. Make sure your cameras are on, and you are unmuted when your item comes up. When you're done with your item, please remute and turn off your camera. Members of the public may comment as to items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda during item number two. Members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in this agenda may do so at the time that each of those items is considered. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click on the raise hand feature in Zoom. You'll be notified when it is your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial *9 to raise your hand. Phone participants will then be called on by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it is your turn to speak, dial *6 to unmute. Members of the public attending in person, there are public comment cards on the table outside. Please complete them and return them to UNI to help expedite public comments. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from the committee members. The committee then comes to a consensus to move the item to the board for consideration. Any PowerPoint shown on tonight's meeting will be posted to the Santa Clarita Valley Water website. At this time, all members of the committee are present. And with that, we will begin with item number one on the agenda, which is the Pledge of Allegiance. Captain Colley, your course is to the flag. Would you be on the committee?
Yes, certainly. Put your right hand over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Moving on to item number two is public comment. We do have one public comment card. So, Haiti, are we ready? And we'll go ahead. Ms. Noltemeyer, go ahead and start when you're ready.
Yes. I took it upon myself a little duty to do at all the meetings until on November 8th, 22, we have an election. That's because the gentleman that arranged for that by going through LAVCO is deceased. I noticed what he did because I always followed that particular program rather than the programs you were doing because I knew there was nobody elected there. And anyway, I just wanted you to be aware of that. There will be the election on the 8th. And that's coming up very quickly. So I don't want anyone to miss it. I hope we will get a board of 9 elected at that time. And I know his reasons for doing that. And it will make a good board because for the first time it will be elected. Thank you.
Just for the public record, the board has been elected forever. So. But yes, there will be election come November 8th. Thank you for your comment, Mr. Clare. Is there anybody online who wants to make a public comment on item number two?
There is none at this time.
Thank you. Then we'll move on to item number three, which is to be presented by Sarah Fleury. It's the recommended adoption of a resolution authorizing the SB 610 water supply assessment for the Shadow Box Studio developments. Sarah, when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Chair Ford. Okay, I'm going to share my screen. Been a while. Is that good?
Yep.
Perfect. Okay, and you can hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. Hold on, I have to mute. I have to hide something myself because I'm in my way. I can't see. So thank you for having me this evening. Clearly, I'm not Rick Vassilopoulos. I'm subbing in for him. He's in Europe. So I will be doing the Shadowbox Studios development water supply assessment presentation for him. We're going to go through the water supply assessment process, talk about the Shadowbox project and its water demands, look at our current and future water supplies, the risks to our water supplies, review our historical operations, supply and demand comparisons, and then we'll get to our recommendations. And I know Rick had mentioned you've seen this same presentation quite a few times with all the other water supply assessments that have come through. So I'm going to offer it up. I'd be happy to skip through to the important parts, or I'm also very happy to do the entire presentation for you as well. It's about 23 slides, and I'll go as quickly as possible.
Can we just see the important parts?
Yeah, Sarah, you can go ahead and go with the highlights.
The highlights, okay.
All right.
Second.
Hearing no objection?
No.
Okay. So I'm going to skip to slide 5. So, the Shadowbox Studio development is located between Via Princesa Avenue and 12th Street, which is east of Railroad Avenue. It's approximately 94 acres within our service area. And on the left-hand side, you can see where it's located here with the star in our service area in Newhall. And then this is a zoomed-in version of the development area. This project is a combination of sound stages, workshops, warehouses, support uses. There's also production and administrative offices, catering and specialty services, and then 17 acres of landscaped irrigation. And the projected water demands were calculated using all the same methods that we used for future demand in the urban plan. Basically, you look at the unit types, which you can see them listed here, landscape, commercial, and industrial, the number of units that they intend on developing. You apply demand factors for each unit, and then you can calculate the estimated demands for each group. So for our total average year demand, it's looking like about 197 acre feet a year, and then 209 acre feet a year in a single dry year, and 201 acre feet a year in multiple dry years. And we did include, as we did in the urban plan, we did include a 25.6% overwatering factor and a 3.7% climate change factor into these calculations. And I'll get into that a little bit more. So you've seen this one. We're going to skip over to slide 9. So this is a graphic which shows us kind of in the urban plan how we calculated out those build out demands. They've grouped, you've got the blue sections of these bar graphs representing existing demand. So we know those demands. The green represents identified future development. So those are developments that we know exactly what they're going to build. Like, is it commercial space, residential units, so forth and so on. And then you have the orange section at the top, which is non-specified new development. So those are developments that we know are going to be coming, but we're not exactly sure of the specifics of them. And so this specific project was grouped into the unspecified development. And if you look at the total on the right-hand side, you'll see that was about almost 23,500 acre feet for these non-specified developments by build out. And so this will account for about 200 acre feet a year of that demand. And that's just about a little under 1% of the total. So the approach that we took for the water supply assessment, again, is very similar to the urban plan. We use the best information that we have available at the time we have it. Obviously, information continues to be updated. So we had to make some updates with the water supply assessments. And there were two main ones that we focused on. One was bringing in some of the information from the drafted 2021 delivery capability report from DWR, and then also looking at some of the modified well production numbers in tables as engineering kind of updates us with schedules, getting those wells back online. So we'll get into a little bit more of that. So the focusing in on the difference of the 2021 delivery capability report. So the urban plan was adopted in June of 2021, and we utilized the 2019 delivery capability report for that plan. So this came out in December of 2021. The difference between the two reports, one was that this updated version utilizes the CalSIM 3, which has a longer hydrologic record. And then they also noted some reductions. One specifically was with regards to the State Water Project average reliability, and there was a reduction from 58% to 56%. And then there was also, they solidified the single dry year being a 7% allocation to a 5% allocation. Then in the urban plan, we had already shown the single dry year as a 5% allocation. So there was no adjustment there, but we did adjust the average reliability portion, which was really only resulted in minor modifications to the reliability table. And then with regards to, updating the well schedules, the restoration of well schedules. So for example, we had Saugus Well 201 and Saugus Well 205. In the urban plan, those were both shown to come online with production in 2022, but things change. You know, they've been adjusted for new permitting and additional VOC treatment for Saugus 201. So that project got pushed out to 2024. And then Saugus Well 205 is planned to come online in 2025. So we made those adjustments. And then similar for the PFAS impacted alluvial wells, there were just some minor adjustments as we move to 2025. Currently we've got 9 wells that will be restored by 2025, and then all the remaining will be restored by 2030, which is pretty close to what we had estimated in the urban plan. So all minor adjustments, but they've been updated the best we could. And then we're gonna shift to slide 20. Okay, so one of the requirements of SB 610 was that we're required to show our demands in a normal year, a single dry year, and a multiple dry year, similar to the urban plan. So this is a real simplified version of those tables. You can see the normal years are represented on the left-hand side here. You've got the supply versus the demand in 5-year increments out to build out. And you've got your remaining balance here, which is all above zero, which is what we want to see. Similar for single dry year in the middle. And then you have your multi-dry year periods on the far right-hand side. And all the demands for the Shadowbox Studio project are included in these comparisons. So in conclusion, we've evaluated the long-term demands compared to the existing and the planned water supplies. All demand projections were utilizing the same methodology as we used in the urban plan with the most. The water supply assessment concluded that the total projected water supplies over the 30-year projection period will be sufficient to meet the projected demands associated with the Chatterbox Studios development, as well as existing and planned future uses. So staff recommends that the Water Resource and Watershed Committee recommend that the Board of Directors for the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency adopt a resolution approving the SB 610 water supply assessment for the Chatterbox Studios development and direct staff to submit the water supply assessment to the City of Santa Clarita. That's
it. Thank you, Sarah. Mm-hmm. Have any cards on this particular item? Uni, is there anybody online who wants to make a comment?
There's none at this time.
Thank you. So with that, then we turn to members of the committee and see if they were interested in any comments on the water supply assessment for this project.
Yes. Okay. You want to follow? So I don't intend for a detailed answer. You know, I emailed you this afternoon, and I appreciate even mentioning it tonight. I look at this kind of like more as a future agenda item. Maybe we could discuss how the wells being down impacts that, and how the data we have currently, where we're stressing those banks, just to give us some comfort that indeed they will rebound. And like I mentioned in the email, I look at the Colorado River that we had 100 years to figure out how screwed up that the assumption that we were just going to be able to just honk on that water. And, now finally, a few folks are beginning to wake up and realize that, we're in trouble. So I don't want to be in 5 years in that situation. I'd rather start to discuss it much sooner than that. So that's really the focus of my question. It's not this particular 200-acre feed. But I appreciate you mentioning it. Thank you. And if we could maybe put that on the agenda at some future time for further discussion, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Any other questions, Director Collin? I was going to have Ed finish.
No, I'm done.
Since he's first out of the game. Director Cooper.
I know this is a small project. It's only 200 acre feet. We've approved three or four water supply assessments, and I know that they're not will serve letters. They're not an obligation to provide. It's just saying that at this time, you can see that our our documents show that we have water for your project. When we did these last numbers, does it take into account the WSAs that we have approved as well? So we're counting those as demands already on the WSAs so that we're not overshooting that mark. But thank you.
Your term touch?
How'd you know? Yes, well, first of all, thank you, Ms. Fleury, for a great presentation, as always. I always appreciate hearing from you. I don't have questions. I just have a couple comments, and they're not going to be new. They're things that I've said before. We've had discussion about the water supply assessments, but I'm going to say them again anyways. I know we have an obligation to say, yes, we have the water, because that's what the Urban Water Management Plan states. But I do worry that we're continuing to say, yes, we have plenty of water, go ahead and build, especially in the climate that we have right now, where we're asking customers to reduce their outdoor irrigation. And I just think it's better practice. I think we need to be forward thinking and say, yes, we think we have the water now based on the Urban Water Management Plan. We don't know what the future is going to hold. We would like you to be partners with us in conserving water going forward. And I know you put some language into the cover letters the last couple of times that I thought was great, asking them to please make sure that they're adhering to things like the model water efficiency landscape ordinance and other examples that I can't remember right now, of using permeable pavement when possible. I think for this project in particular, since it's being built over a creek, I think it's especially important to remind them of that. And I can't remember the other examples right now, but I just think it's important to ask them to be partners with us in conservation as we send these documents out, and not just in the cover letter, but also in the water supply assessment. So,
And you're referring to the city as well. And
city and county. Yes, city and county, because these are who these documents are going to.
Yeah.
And then I know why you put the overwatering factor into your calculations. I don't like advertising that to the builders and the developers. I mean, I get why you cushion it in your numbers internally. I just think it's bad messaging to say, and here's some extra water on top of that, because we know you're going to overwater. So I would like to see that not be in the documents and the language as well. And those are my comments. Thank you.
Maria.
Yeah, well, I actually would... I have a couple of questions as follow-up to that. So is the language of this WSA different than what we've seen before, or is it basically the same? When it talks about the conservation language in the cover letter, and it's the same?
It's the same language.
Okay. And then the overwatering, I mean, I'm hearing that people are saying we underestimated our water supply. Been to some meetings where that was said, that it overestimates our water supply. So I think that, you know, as a counterpoint, I think including an overwatering factor shows that we're being protective of our existing customers by, you know, buffering that estimation. We're not giving them more water per se. We're just assuming that there may be human errors in operation. There may be, you know, periodic issues that we need to account for. So I think it shows concern for our customers if we mention that we've conservatively estimated higher to be sure that we have enough water. If we need to make it clear that it's not, you know, giving them extra water, I don't know how we would do that, but if we're not giving them
number. You're paying for that extra 25% too. I mean,
for connection.
Connection fees, is that correct? Or is that just for our...
Probably, the way the connection fee policy works currently is that it's meter-based, so it's demand-based. So if they were building to achieve using that much more water, and the engineer said they needed that through a meter connection, then they would pay. If they're designing to MeWello, they should be sizing appropriately to do that. We'll be paying based on that meter size.
And this would take into consideration too, wouldn't it, that when they're building a new project, all the landscaping you put in is new.
Yeah.
And everybody overwaters to get their landscaping going, and it takes a few years to do that. So
it is conservative.
I think so. I think it helps by putting that 25% in there, and I see what Director Armitage is talking about too. But I think it helps us in the numbers know that we're not cutting it too slim.
Right.
In the
Can
end.
Can we keep that internal, though, in our internal documents and say, okay, we're factoring for overwatering internally, but not necessarily advertising it?
Well, I mean, we're a public agency, so there's not really anything that's internal. This is
for the public
to understand. And if some of the public thinks we're overestimating our water availability or somehow doing something shady, I want to highlight that we're being cautious.
Maybe there's another term that can be used besides overwatering.
Yeah,
it's kind of a funny term.
But, buffering factor?
That 25% is only applied, though, to the irrigation, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
So it's a small, actually, it's probably a small portion for a project like this with all those.
It's only 17 acres. So.
One of the things that we have done, we have reached out to the city and the county. So those discussions have not been fruitful yet. We are trying to pursue the city and the county to understand the role of kind of the enforcement side of the MeWello standard. So it is a challenge when you have a planning agency planning to something, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a calculation that's done, the planting materials are done a certain way to achieve that calculation. It's inspected and installed that way. But the challenge is going forward, who picks up that ball? Mm-hmm. And it's really difficult for a planning agency to continue that ball rolling because they don't have customers. Mm-hmm. Necessarily, right? Landscape maintenance districts may be a little bit different, but a normal customer are our customers. And so we're trying to open that discussion with them about how do we together work to achieve the standard that is laid out. So I'm hopeful that there'll be more to come on that, but it has been slow going so far.
Well, thank you for starting that.
Would it be possible to change the slide to at least say the landscape total reflect additional overwatering? And it looks like the landscape totals are less than a third of the project. So.
Yeah, we can certainly do that. That's
excess landscape use, water use or something.
Yeah. I don't know what can work on the language for overwatering, but establishment watering or something like that, landscape establishment watering, or
are these factors?
And then you could go into the rabbit hole of how long is it established, and it could be never ending.
Are we talking about the additional water for the single dry year and multiple dry year factors?
It's on this slide with the water
Any other questions from members of the committee or staff? I don't know if you wanted more answers. I had a couple of questions. I couldn't quite square the square footage on the project. I thought I came up with a little different total of square footage than was used ultimately to. And Sarah, can you go to the slide where you have, first of all, the project's square footage in each land use category and then the demand one? Start with the one where the project.
One second.
There's kind of small numbers. I don't think there was a big big difference. I would just thought we might not have been consistent. Maybe it had been an earlier project description or something.
This slide?
Yeah, that's one slide, but there's also a slide of the uses on site.
That one.
So if I add those numbers up with the totals you have for that slide you just showed me, where you calculated demand, it didn't look like they matched precisely. They were close, but the total of interior space, and it looks like we are using there's 266,000 square feet of commercial office, and then just over a million of industrial. And like I said, they're just kind of almost rounding errors, but you or Rick, they'll check the numbers and calculate the amount that you came up with, because I came up with a slightly different number.
Okay, I'll have Rick check that because he put this all together. I just present.
And then 17.1 acres of landscape irrigation. Is that include the nursery?
That is a mystery that we were talking about this morning.
Okay.
Is it what?
There's a nursery on site. They're gonna on the east side of the project site, almost for the entire site, they have this long, narrow nursery, and they're going to use these plants as...
Oh, like potted trees that they move around.
Yeah. So I didn't know if that's part of the landscaping or not. I was just more curious than anything else. And just to tie those things down before we go to the board with this. And then there's kind of a bigger philosophical issue, and Steve, you and I have talked about this. And Sarah, do you know the slide where you show the available water that we use, the one with the bar graph, and it showed residential, future residential, and so on? There you go. I think this is fine as far as it goes. My one concern, and this maybe not be something that we think about until 2025 or at least during the preparation of water management plan, is so this particular project, the land use for the project was a mixed use residential commercial development, which would have been a lot higher water use than what they're proposing here. So we have a project comes down in terms of use, 100 acres of land, and the total water use is 200 acres per year, which is small and relative, you know, to the area involved. My concern is that you had a project that came in and said, we're going to be a water bottling project, and all of our identified future development is taken out in a single project. And I thought that the demand figures in the Olden Water Management Plan were generated by a land use factor that was then aggregated by not us to come up with that figure. And if we have a project, you know, Meadows calculated X, and we find out that the proposed project is 3X, you know, it may still fit within the bar and on the bar right hand side, but does it take up a lot more water demand than we thought it would? And now suddenly we're finding ourselves on a little short supply as a result. The good news is every 5 years we update your water management plan so we can, you know, catch that stuff. But I just wonder if there's some kind of threshold for demand where we say, you know, you may need to do a little more in this regard. So this is thrown out for staff's long-term future consideration. Obviously, this project is copacetic in that regard. And so I'll support the water supply assessment for this project. Hopefully we can tighten up that math.
This one kind of does the opposite,
right?
Because that was in the whole urban water management plan that was identified with higher water use than what's going on there.
So, that might be more common than the nightmare scenario I had, because there's a lot of projects the developers come in and between economic realism and planners and whatever, they say, oh, well, we'll build something smaller. I think the village at Wiley Canyon was another case where increased densification probably resulted in a lower water demand than Maddox calculated for that particular project site. I don't recall, but anyway, that's kind of the thing you need to, I'm sorry, Steve, just for a second, just to watch for is where the planners say something to the effect that, you know, we're going to need a general plan amendment for this particular project. Because the old timers, like you and I know, we calculated this on the basis of the traffic assessment zones. That was our model. So the planners get something that generates three times the traffic that they expected. You know, alarm bells go off. We start talking about possible project denial or lots of mitigation to get the traffic down. We fortunately, our impacts are more broad-spread. We don't necessarily have those kind of tight impacts, but it still may be something that we have to sometime down the road.
I think it's a great thought. We will definitely think through that a little bit. You know, one of the things that kind of falls into that thing is this idea of redevelopment, right? And I think our community is going to see a lot more of that as the spaces are harder and harder to develop, you know, on the fringes, so to speak. I think you're going to see a lot more focus on redevelopment, you know, within certain areas of the community. Maybe it's going to go vertical or whatever, but I think that would have the similar challenge where you had a, you know, a footprint of a single story, whatever.
In existing demand.
And now you're going vertical. And so I think it's definitely something that needs to be on our radar, and we can look at those things and see if we can strategize about how to think through that.
Okay.
Well, okay. I want to add to that, because that actually came up at Newhall way back when. And one issue that I remember us talking about is, you know, the change of use within a particular zone. So, right, if something is permitted commercial or industrial, there's never a look at if it changes within the permitted zone. There's like, you know, no EIR, no nothing. They can generally change, and they can change staffing size. So actually, my husband, I used this example at Newhall. Business building was over here, and it was permitted, I want to say, as like they were doing set fabrication or something, and had like 20 employees, and then he's changed to 3. For years. So where is there a credit? What happens with that? And then similarly, what if you have an operation that changes from, you know, it might be a dental office to a restaurant or a laundromat. There could be high water use things go in too that also don't get, certainly not EIR treatment. So maybe the demand, like actual demands true that up or something, maybe there's a true up to not have to like look at who's operating every building in the entire city, but maybe there's some true up that you can think of. Cause we talked about it and it is quite an effort. So yeah.
That's good input as well. Yeah. It's a complex issue when you start.
Sometimes we'll catch stuff at the facility capacity fee stage where there's a modification to a building, but it wouldn't be part of the planning process if it's not a big. So, yeah. Anyway, one more layer.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
Thank you. And then I also wanted to mention, I agree with Dr. Armitage about the cover letter addressing permeable paving, perhaps. But in this particular case, they're not building in Placer Creek. They have a bridge over it to parking. So that the creek itself, the channel, will probably be, you know, able to have infiltration of water, but yes, so, you know, permeable paving on a lot of parking may be good.
Can I ask a follow-up to that? Or,
sure.
Trying to form my question. So if a geohydrologist were to look at that, because it is kind of at the end of the creek right there, and I realize it's right across the street from current development, so it's kind of at the end point of that, but would it be something that we should be concerned about in terms of affecting our recharge? Is there a map of recharge areas that we prefer, maybe the city and the county, to kind of stay away with anything that they're building I mean, is that something that we can include in our conversations with them, perhaps, just to let them know that we want to try to protect our recharge areas as best as possible to help our groundwater supplies? Just a thought.
We'll definitely, you know, as kind of the process of these environmental reviews, right? So there will definitely be geology work that goes on the site. They, as part of the green building ordinance now, they're required to do infiltration on site. So before it was like, oh, if you were a good developer, you did that. But now it's a requirement. And right. So there will be a whole analysis of how that site is changing and impacting that. So, you know, the staff we get were noticed on the environmental reviews themselves. And so just like our water supply assessment will go in and be part of that and the overall analysis for the project, we will get a chance to review and comment on the other information that's contained in there. So we, you know, the short answer is we will look at that issue and see that it's appropriately addressed.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members of the committee for staff? Are you ready to move this item on to the board? Any objection to moving it on to the board?
No, I'm good. And we can try a high-level summary rather than a longer presentation since we have seen this many times, but have the information available if someone asks.
Okay. Good. So we'll move it on then to the board.
Thank you.
So with that, then, we'll move on to item 4, which is to be presented by Matt Dickens, and that's recommending authorizing the general manager to execute a construction contract for the Bridgeport Pocket Park. Matt, if you are ready.
Yes, Chair Ford, can you hear me okay?
We can, thank you.
Okay, fantastic. So let me get my computer set up here. I think this is it. Now I gotta change display settings and move this little piece over here. Okay, can you guys see my screen okay?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, fantastic. So I'm thank you very much, Chair Ford and members of the Water Resources Watershed Committee. I'm Matt Dickens, Sustainability Manager. And I'm very excited to be here tonight to present on the Bridgeport Pocket Park, which is a collaborative partnership to bring conservatory gardens to the SCB that we have been working on since shortly after the agency launched in 2018. So very excited. Before I move forward, I would like to acknowledge all the people that worked on this, including our sustainability conservation staff, engineering staff, the city's staff, our local landscape designers, and engineering and irrigation support firms that help provide, as well as GIS and IT staff. So this is really a collaborative effort with many, many different groups in the agency and throughout the community. Okay, so tonight's presentation objectives are to seek the Water Resources and Watershed Committee approval to recommend that the SCB Water Board of Directors to authorize the general manager to execute a construction contract for Bridgeport Pocket Park. I'll provide an overview of the concept design process, an overview of the request for proposals, bid process, and outcomes, review of the project added value and strategic goals that the project provides and supports, and then we'll conclude with questions and answers. So regarding the Pocket Park project overview, this again started in 2018-2019 with sustainable landscaping and water efficient irrigation demonstration strategy, which looked at our conservatory garden education experience hoping to develop pocket parks. And again, this is also supplemental to the board, the staff report that I included in the committee packet. So in the strategy, it was the goal to look at the agency's landscape assets and determine ways to improve, maximize, and enhance our ability to demonstrate these landscape technologies, plant palettes, and strategies to the community, as well as ways to look at improving the bigger conservation garden education experience design, but then also developing ways to have gardens incorporated into common high visibility, high traffic areas throughout the community. In 2019, SCB Water in the city of Santa Clarita conducted a park-at-park site analysis and recommendation. I'll go through that. In 2019, we developed a memorandum of understanding between SCB Water and the city of Santa Clarita. And through that, that allowed us to look at developing the site, partnering on the maintenance of the site where the agency or the city would take over kind of your basic maintenance. That's weed management, mulch replenishment, trash management, those types of things. And the agency would have a marginal kind of maintenance level where we look at ways to improve those things that are specific beyond those basic components. So it's a partnership in management and maintenance. It also leverages the city's existing insurance to cover damages to the site. We had a collaborative garden site design process, and I'll explain that shortly. In 2020 and 2021, we worked with our site engineer, our internal staff engineering, and external support to develop grading plans, drainage plans, and new irrigation system design plans. And then we put that information out to RFP in 2022, and here we are today to present to you on the responses that we received on September 2nd. So when we look at Bridgeport Pocket Park and site selection, there were 8 sites that the group reviewed that the city had essentially turned off irrigation to during the 2011 to 2017 drought. Those places included Discovery Park, Bridgeport Park, Valencia Meadows, Creek View, Camp Plenty, Magic Mountain Trailhead, Oak Springs Park, and Canyon Country Community Center, which was under construction at the time. The group conducted a criterion analysis matrix overview and analysis and determined that the most ideal site for this initial pocket park would be Bridgeport Park because of its location, its visibility, and its size and other components. And so with that, the group selected Bridgeport Pocket Park to develop the this demonstration garden park. In the collaborative design process, this was very interesting. Typically, a firm will go to a landscape contracting firm or a landscape architect and say, we want to do, you know, this plan. We want to develop this site. We want to put in new plants, new sustainability features, all these signs and benches, grading, and so on and so forth. It kind of goes to a single entity to do a more holistic approach. In this, what we wanted to do, because this is primarily a demonstration garden for residents and businesses as alike, we worked with 4 different landscape designers to come up with kind of different styles and approaches to sustainable landscape design. And these designers are folks that we work with regularly in our lawn replacement program. So each one of them got a section of the garden in which the case they could showcase their preferences, their stylistic design prowess, and other types of components. We have drought-tolerant native plants embedded in this landscape, so mostly most of the plants, all of them are water-efficient, low-water-use plants, but most of them are drought-tolerant natives as well. However, we did have to conduct another criterion analysis matrix to make sure that we didn't put in plants that were not robust or hardy, considering that there may be some trampling or other types of components as is exposed at this facility. So the city had some criterion recommendations for us, and we incorporated that in analysis and came up with a very robust plant palette that incorporates those drought-tolerant native plants. The city also was did not have specifications and a preference to use drip irrigation. So this pocket park would use high-efficiency spray irrigation using MP rotators and low precipitation nozzles of 0.4 inches per hour, which have head-to-head coverage and can get up to about 80%. Efficiency. And we do allow that in our lawn replacement program as well. But we also asked the city if we could have some drip irrigation demonstration within the garden. And there's a section where that will be demonstrated. Additional features include sustainability features. You've got rain gardens. We have bio swales. We have hydrozone features. We have mulching. We have entrance and plant signs. We have permeable concrete pad, which is over here in the kind of the upper right-hand corner of the park, right where this fork is in the pathway there. And that can be used to feature electric vehicles or tiny homes or other types of programming. This is a recommendation that came, I believe, from Director Gutzeit. And so we were able to incorporate that in design as well to not only provide a pad for the maintenance folks to park their vehicles and work from, but also to demonstrate and include enhanced programming for the community going forward. And then there's also pathways and benches. So in many ways, this is a learning landscape museum in some ways. So there's multiple different points of entry. I think there's four different points of entry here. And you kind of walk your way through the garden and around and kind of, and you know, see and from all different angles, kind of look at various different types of designers' approaches, landscape palettes, irrigation practices, and so on and so forth, sustainability practices. In August 2022, we went to solicitation for requests for proposals via Planet Bids. We received those proposals in September. We did receive four proposals from CS Legacy Construction, United Construction and Landscape, RC Becker and Son, and Marina Landscape. We evaluated the proposals, and the lowest cost bid selected was at $373 here, which is shown. That is up from the $230,000 that we had initially budgeted and planned for this project. A couple of things occurred in the time we budgeted to what we determined from the RFPs. These things included, there's inflation. There is a need to redesign the irrigation system, which typically when a residential customer or a small business or a business customer retrofits or converts their landscape, they can use conversion kits to modify the sprinkler system. In this case, because of the complexity and the need for various different hydro zones and the size of the project, it was determined best feasibility because it had big rotors, head-to-head coverage with these big rotors for the turf in the area, we had to modify that and develop a new sprinkler system. So that was another component. There is some earthwork and some engineering that we had to incorporate in this project. And then I think those two things, along with inflation, are kind of the big pieces, as well as the concrete pad added to our estimate. So with that, though, the lowest bid was CS Legacy Construction at $373,147.60. We look at our budget again. We have budgeted $230,000. And in discussions with staff, we do believe that there is a budget that we can utilize this fiscal year from the conservatory garden to supplement that delta should the committee and the board adopt and approve the construction of the project. So the value proposition and strategic goal support, there's quite a bit. In strategic plan, I outline those in the staff report, and those incorporate providing more opportunities for the community to interact and engage with sustainable, low water use, drought tolerant native landscapes. It also promotes drought tolerant water efficiency landscapes. It communicates with customers, the conservation is the way of life. It integrates demonstration functions with existing parks. Bridgeport Pocket Park is a very popular park with softball, with soccer. It hosts numerous special events, including 4th of July, firework views where thousands of people show up. Every day people drop their kids off at Bridgeport School, elementary school. There are people who walk through the park in the community. So it's very highly visible with a lot of community traffic and just really provides a great opportunity for folks to interact with this type of landscaping, to get inspiration out for opportunities for their turf conversion projects. And again, that improves in community access to this demonstration garden. It enhances our education programming by providing additional facilities for us to have events at or to promote other sustainable education offerings, such as the electric vehicle or tiny homes or smart irrigation, or even landscape contractor training. When it comes to understanding how to maintain, prune native landscape plants and drought-tolerant landscape plants and routine mulching and other types of practices, that there is a huge gap currently in the professional landscape world, as well as those in the kind of the mom-and-pop shops. In addition to that, it converts turf area to sustainable garden. Because that area used to be turf, it would no longer be turf and the city would maintain it. We would have a partnership to maintain it, and eventually the city would take ownership of that. So with that, staff recommends that the Water Resource and Watershed Committee recommend to the SCB Water Board of Directors to authorize the general manager to execute a construction contract for Bridgeport Pocket Park. And like I said at the onset of this presentation, this project has been an eye-opener, a great learning experience, but also a fantastic opportunity to coordinate, collaborate, and partner with many different entities across the valley. And we think this is a good opportunity to continue that spirit and promote smart, sustainable landscapes to the community. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Matt. I have no public comment cards on this item. Any, is there anybody online who wants to comment on item number four?
There's none.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee for Matt? Director Colley, start.
Just real quick question, Matt. Did I miss how many acres and area this park is?
It's roughly 16,000 square feet, so, less than half an acre.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your great presentation. Thank you to the whole team that's participating and making this happen. Appreciate it. I'm excited about this project too. I think this will be a great way for community members to come out and see and get ideas of different ways they can make changes to their own landscaping at home. As you mentioned, to both save money and save water, but also as a bonus to help with our biodiversity in our whole valley. So I think that's fantastic. Just a few comments and questions. I just wanted to thank you for making it known about the permeable concrete pad. Regarding the budget, is the city putting any funds into it, this?
Director Armitage, is a great question. In terms of the construction, the city's contribution has been staff time in the site location, but also in the MOU, they would cover with their insurance coverage or existing insurance coverage, and they would provide basic landscape maintenance.
When they take it over, yeah, right.
Well, from the day we after the construction warranty's up, we have a collaborative maintenance agreement where the city maintains the basic components and we maintain and we take over like the marginal components.
Okay. So since it's over what was allocated for it, and you were saying that you can pull from the conservatory garden budget, but is that, I was under the impression from previous presentations that the budget for the conservatory garden was over budget too.
We adjusted the budget, Director Armitage, for the conservatory garden to match those increased costs. We would have to address that issue in the next budget cycle, the marginal price difference here between the 370 and the 230, I think it's 143. But the point, I think the issue is that our discussion was that budget's available in the conservatory garden because we, while we're moving closer to finishing that park, and we'll be coming soon with a proposal and more information and cost estimate on that park, those funds would not be expended this year. Okay. So the budget's available, but we would have to address it in the next budget cycle as well.
Okay, thanks. Let's see, we can answer that. So I was trying to look at the plant list and I was going cross-eyed because it is so tiny in the packet that we have. So I'm wondering, or I guess I could enlarge it, right, on my screen to try to read it. I'm just trying to figure out how I can read the plant list because I would be interested in seeing that.
Oh, you know what? We have a plant list that was included in the bid packet. I'd be happy to send that to you.
Okay, thanks. And then you kind of alluded to the fact that this is the first. Do we have an idea of how many more potentially we might want to do in the future?
Well, I think as pilot projects go, in this case, this is a pilot project. I think we'd want to get this project working, assess its engagement, assess its success, and then learn from that and perhaps incorporate that in other parts. There are 7 sites on top of this that the city identified. Some of those are not feasible. They would not provide a very good opportunity. They're like back in the back off of the beaten path. And so they're not really, you know, feasible for this type of park. But I tend to think that if this goes well, which we envision that it could be, there could be other areas, specifically as we start looking towards that non-functional turf component that has now been banned by the State Water Resources Control Board. And there's probably a lot more spaces that are outside of those sports fields and that are currently turf that might make some really suitable peripheral linked sites for us. So I think that we have some new opportunities with us, but we'd want to assess that before we move forward.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. And then lastly, I have found in my own personal native gardening experience that it's you do need some extra learning and training to work with natives. So I just want to make sure, in order to set this up for success and hopefully replicate this, if we have positive feedback, I just want to make sure that whoever's going to be doing the maintenance or taking on the responsibility for maintenance very much understands that they do need that kind of extra education and training specifically on the care of native plants and kind of the evolution of that. So I just want to make sure that that's also being considered.
Yeah, absolutely. Our side of the maintenance would need to incorporate somebody with that expertise. Our goal is to have those eyes be expert eyes that can make recommendations for optimal outcomes of this garden.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we want to use it to leverage to train new customers and other opportunities and other landscape contractors. So, but in order for this to do well and work well, it needs to be a beautiful example of what sustainable gardens can be. And so that's definitely, we're compelled, and that's in our interest to maintain.
Great. Thank you so much.
Dr. Gutzeit.
Yeah, a few questions. What was the original $230,000 estimate, like an engineering estimate? Was it back in the napkin guess? How did we go over 50% over from a budget that was just adopted this year?
Yeah, the great question, Director Gutzeit. The original estimate looked at premium turf conversion projects that our landscape designers provided cost estimates on. And then we looked at the engineering estimates. The pieces that were missed, of course, were the inflation, but then also the geo work that needs to happen for drainage, which is critical to maintaining the landscape, but then also the refurbishment of the irrigation system, or actually not just refurbishment, but a whole new installation, removal and installation of a new irrigation system to make sure that it has head-to-head coverage, which improves its distribution uniformity and provides the type of irrigation needed to sustain the garden. That was a component that typically is not required. And so we looked at the $10 to $15 per square foot, which puts us right around $200,000 to $210,000. And those other components in our cost estimates were things that kind of boosted that.
Okay. That makes sense. Because, I mean, inflation was 9%, not in excess of 50%.
Yeah.
The geo work, I can imagine, is expensive. And irrigation is definitely expensive. I mean, I would just... This area is really pretty small. I mean, I go by it regularly. So, you know, it looks like, I mean, I'm not going to question the experts, but it looks like a lot of irrigation for a little patch. I'm just going to say the same thing that I said at finance. We need to watch these projects when they come in and say X. You know, I'd like us to see, you know, how can we do this for less? Because, you know, a homeowner certainly is not going to spend $370,000 on this little patch of wood chips that is there now. And, you know, can we go back and say, what would you say? I mean, the designer is going to design something beautiful. And there's going to be a balance between somebody walking up to this and going, wow, this is gorgeous. When you put that into your house, you're not going to put in 5-gallon shrubs. You're going to put in smaller shrubs and let them grow. And every installer is going to tell you that. So I'm assuming these designers went with the pretty 5-gallon shrubs kind of thing. I don't know. If not for this, then going forward, I certainly would like to see something more realistic that we can, you know, ask homeowners to adopt. Because, you know, when you do it at your house, you're getting a little thing like this big and you're told, you know, it'll look good in a couple years. And I know we don't want that, but.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I tend to think that on your own and with some modifications, you can do a very beautiful, sustainable landscape conversion under $10 per square foot at a typical home. Mm-hmm. For this particular project, we boosted it to $15 per square foot, but it came in at $23.32. So it definitely increased over that. And you're right, there are some things in this that might be very different than a homeowner would do. But at the same time, this is a project that is designed to be kind of the creme de la creme. And so it needs to stand out and kind of be a gem of that type of project, the best example of it. But I agree, we'll definitely look into better cost estimates. With the conservatory garden, I can say that those cost estimates, the engineering firm at the 75%, 100% is providing far more elaborate cost estimates in the engineering work, the demolition work, the costs. And so this one, it kind of came in from designers who are working in the residential sector. Yeah. And their estimates, I think, are probably pretty good for the residential sector, but not as it came out for this project.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, if there's anything that they can do to say, you know, that would be reasonable, I think we should ask our final contractor. Because it's also packed with plants. I mean, again, when you plant at your house, you do not plant a plant here and a plant here. Plant here and a plant here.
Yeah.
I just don't want us to appear to be frivolous with the public's money on these things, just because they're important. I mean, everything's important, but we need to use caution here. Planting time. When are they going to plant?
So if we were to approve this project, we would need to determine at which board meeting it would go. Procurement would take about 2 to 4 weeks. Planting would take, or this construction planning and scheduling would probably take another month. So planting ideally would be done later this fall or early in the spring, which is the window of opportunity that we have typically in our valley.
Right. So if they don't, for some reason, if they get delayed, we have to hold off. If they're going to plant past March, it'll be too late. We're going to waste our money and everything will die. Are they going to have designer name tags out there for the who did the designs? Can we do that? Because I always say the homeowners don't know who to call.
That was one of the benefits of doing the collaborative landscape project, is that we can promote who did the design.
Okay.
That was one of the benefits, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to see that because, you know, I mean, I was looking at the names. I'm like, oh, I got to put these people on my list because you never know who to call. And then
they're on our website, Director Goodsites. So these are folks that we promote in our landscape designer assistance program.
Oh, cool. Okay. And then lastly, if we have to go to other sites, now that the schools are going to be burdened with taking out their non-functional turf, can we, separate agenda item, but can we look at, schools or other areas? Or are we restricted to City of Santa Clarita property for these educational gardens?
Director Goodsite, we're not restricted to the City of Santa Clarita. If there's a collaboration partnership opportunity, we can certainly vent that through the process. But to that point, we have been working with the school districts to fund landscape conversion projects through our lawn replacement program. So
cool. Okay. Oh, and just one tiny little note on the quote. I noticed that the construction notes on page 178 of our packet say that they're going to put in plugs of Chirupa. That was probably to hold it until they planted it. They didn't plant that. It's wood chips. So make sure we didn't get charged for that. The Chirupa?
The crop, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
how would you pronounce that?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. Many of us do. Director
Goodsett. Yeah. So I don't want to see a bill for Krupa because it's wood chips, and I'm sure we got a wood chip bill already, or will. But yeah. they shouldn't put, obviously, they're not going to put that in. They're going to put in their showcase plants.
Okay.
Yeah, just one more comment, Mr. Dickens. I'm wondering if you're going to be speaking with Dr. Jeannie Chari at COC anytime soon. I would encourage you to maybe let her know that the agency is starting to do this, because I know she's doing some type of research around native plants and biodiversity, and I'm wondering if like this would tie in nicely with one of their research projects or something. So just throwing that out.
Thank you, Director Armitage. We have been in contact with the COC professor, and so we'll reach out and continue to collaborate with him.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yep. Jeannie. Yep.
No other questions from the committee, Matt. I just had a quick question. Is the city's approvals all lined up? You don't have to take, this doesn't have to go in front of the Parks or Rec Commission and or City Council?
That's not my understanding, Chair Ford, that we have signed the MOU and they have signed off on the plans, and we will be coordinating with them through the construction. They're ready for this site to be converted from its existing non-use to something that they can promote as well.
Okay, that's good. And then lastly, do you have planned signage for like our conservation programs to be incorporated in the park?
Yeah, so there's kind of different phases to the engagement. There are plant signs throughout the site, and we had in the construction bid, we asked for backups because we know those things tend to break over time or you know, weather. But there's also signage around the entrances, and there's a monument sign on one of the corners, and then there's an information kiosk in the center of it, which we can put all kinds of signage in, including information on our conservation program. Our goal is to make sure that there's materials there that folks can learn from, take with them, but then eventually we could turn this into something that has digital virtual capabilities that people could interact with and build a plant list, or you know, review more about the design or different types of landscape practices, or watch a video of the process from where it is today to what would be full growth in the full establishment. So our first one is to develop those signs that people can interact with while they're there, and then to start building some digital virtual capabilities to interact with them.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. Director Crawley.
Yeah, the price of this just flat out seems shocking to me. It sounds like we provided guidance to the designers. Essentially, they understood to say, money is no object, do what you want. If I was the only one on the committee, my inclination would be to send this back to staff and say, you know, we can't be spending over $250,000 on a half an acre of dirt. That's just seems insane. So I'm not going to be in favor of this. I would prefer that we sharpen our pencils a little bit, even if it requires smaller plants and that sort of thing. I don't know what it would require, but this price tag for half an acre is just, no individual in this valley, or few individuals in this valley, would think that a reasonable price tag to do their own landscaping. So
I'm going to, you know, second your suggestion, because I mean, I'd like to see what that looks like. I'm not sure a business would even spend this money. And also, I know if you ask, when you plant, you don't plant the big plants, maybe some for a nice look, but I mean, what were they told? Were they told this is the approximate budget? What do you got? Or was it like, what, you know, dream away? What do you propose? What was that conversation?
Well, again, Director Goodsight and Director Colley, I think if you look at the plants, the plant cost is within the $10 to $15 per square foot, which is a reasonable cost. A little bit higher end. Again, I think on your own and smaller plants, you could probably get this down to $7, maybe $10 per square foot. What I think the big cost differences here are, again, that head-to-head coverage, which is an irrigation system, which is critical to the survival and the operation of the garden. So there's also some other components in there that are very aesthetic, but it is designed to be inspirational. And so one way I think to look at it is certainly $23 per square foot is a high expense for a business, also a high expense for a homeowner. For what could have 5,000 to 10,000 customers walking through it per year over 10 years, that's a very small amount of money to provide inspiration to folks, which is a little bit different than what those other structures and what the tangible outcomes for those sites are. So I think in this case, it's a fairly decent expense for the value that we're getting out of it to promote to the community. Again, though, the plant components, they're within the range that we typically see. It's the irrigation components and the geo work that came back to us that boosted us over, and as well as the inflation cost that boosted us over the $10 to $15 estimate we had initially.
I'm gonna argue with this because I've seen this. I mean, it's like twice the size of this room. It's not very big, and if that irrigation was $100,000, we're getting ripped off, frankly. I mean, I'm sorry. I've been to too many meetings where, like, we have these non-real world cost estimates. And if they're quoting that, they're ripping us off. And when you do an install at your house, you're going to have, I mean, every single time they want to redo the irrigation, it's like, here's the irrigation, here's this. I mean, you know, I did some work that was $160,000 over the years that included irrigation, plants, et cetera, for an area 10 times as big, probably. I mean, maybe not 10 times. Maybe I got that wrong. But either way, bigger and for less. And this is, it's like two times the size of this room. I mean, I just feel like if anybody sees the cost estimate on this, and also to follow up on, I do think we can have some pretty plants. But the expectation, when you see homeowners and they don't want to change or a business, they don't want to change, it's because they'll look at something, and it may not be maintainable either. They'll look at something that's gorgeous, and then they find out the cost for that, and then what they get instead is, like, you know, little stubs, and they're told it's going to wait a few years and it'll look nice. Why don't we show them the process that here's where you start? And, you know, year one photo, year two photo, year three photo, because they're going to look at this and they're going to look at what that costs for them to install. And they're not going to be able to afford it. If they're inspired and then they get a quote, they're going to stop. I really would like to see an alternative on this. It's really high to me.
Yeah. It's insane. Matt, could you describe the amount of hardscape being required? And is this going to be concrete work? What are you talking about, rural pathways and such?
Oh, well, so there are decomposed granite pathways throughout the entire site that kind of creates that walking path. But really the geo work is for the drainage and sustainability features, like the rain gardens and the dry creek beds that run through, which is very common. Practice the concrete pad, I want to say, you know, was not sizable, but you're looking at about $10,000 to $11,000 for the permeable concrete pad. But really, it came into, again, the irrigation system, the concrete pad, the drainage to make sure that the plants don't run away, and that, you know, this tends to have like a bowl effect currently, so we need to move water away from the center of this so that we don't destroy the infrastructure that we put into the site. I think that answers your question, Director Ford.
Thank you. So, Director Cooper.
Yeah, you know, I want us to put together a project that is going to make the agency look good, that's going to promote having sustainable gardens in people's yards, But I, you know, when we did it, $230,000, I thought, wow, that's a lot of money back then. I'm a little shocked now. I know that irrigation systems cost a lot of money to install, commercial irrigation systems. This isn't a home irrigation system. But I'm concerned that we're going a little too far on this one. And I don't know what there is. Maybe come back to us with a better estimate broken down to show us what it's going to take to build this, because at $23 a square foot, you know, we can carpet it and make it look pretty good. I'd like to just see some more information on it, because the cost seems pretty high on it. But I don't want us to cheap it like it's built from Home Depot.
Right.
I want us to have something that's going to look to the public out there and make them want to put in drought tolerant plants. But I think we need a little more information.
So I'm hearing consensus that we return this item at the next meeting, hopefully after staff does some work to
pencil sharpening.
Pencil sharpening, as Director calls it.
Just one thing on that I just want to point out, you know, so we went through a design process, we've gone to bid, we've gotten four qualified bids. All of those bids are within very close proximity to one another. So
yeah,
I just want the committee to understand the expectation, you know, short of some kind of major redesign on the project. I mean, I don't think you're gonna shave a bunch by going from
back. I think they might have to redesign.
And I don't know that I see the value in going through that exercise. I mean, I would personally probably just rather we spend staff time doing something else if that's going to be the desire of the committee. You know, we've gone through a very elaborative process here. It is expensive. I find comfort in the fact that the design has received, you know, qualified bids from four different contractors at the same amount. So I think this project costs that much right now,
right,
is the point I'm trying to make. So I don't want to put something together that is not going to reflect well on what we're trying to achieve as an agency. So happy to go back, look at it. We can come back with the numbers, show you the cost breakdown. But short of some kind of major change in the approach,
yeah,
I don't think we're going to have the project. So I just want the committee to be aware of that.
You know, if it's a breakdown and we can get a better understanding of why does it cost that much money to put this together,
yeah,
then I'm fine with it. Because like you, I don't want something that's going to reflect poorly on the agency.
Yeah, we'd certainly be happy to do that.
Yeah,
come back and walk in.
Yeah.
Director Armitage, question?
I think also if we can maybe better understand a return on investment as well. So if, you know, if we're going to be putting this in, as you mentioned, if we anticipate X number of people to see the garden, you know, each year or whatever, how we think that might drive change in behavior and use of the lawn replacement program, which will drive down demand. You know, if we can maybe get some cost of what we might actually see in savings in return for that money, that might be helpful part of the discussion too. And maybe make more of us feel comfortable.
That's a tough one. It's hard to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if there's any research or studies out there to look at.
We can make estimates based off of site or park visits and work with the city to get some data and use some of those types of analyses. It'd be very difficult to show the value of the education. Typically it's 5% of usage, but that, again, that's another number that is, you know, you're talking about anchoring it to something that's a very kind of heuristic as opposed to a case study or a controlled experiment derived number. But nonetheless, we can put together some statistics for your review. But I do want to second what Steve said, and that is that, you know, this did go through the RFP process. These are public bids. for us to transform those bids significantly, we'd have to look at the impacts to the RFP process because everybody had the opportunity to bid on the same project, and that's what we saw. So we don't want to create any type of unfair advantage or change that bid process.
Well, I also would like to see the scope of work for the design too. When we talk about this again, can we see the scope of work for the design? Like what were they asked to design? What were the parameters? Because I think that informs probably what they quote. I mean, I'm just looking at one corner here, calls for 4 24 inch box trees. Those are big, big old trees. And, you know, I don't know. Did we ask them for that? Did they come up with that? Was there anything, was there a price, estimated price range when they did the design? You know, we might've got ourselves stuck in a loop here. Because I remember we were doing this because it was more affordable and maybe more exposure than a full retrofit of the main garden. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it's been a while. We need to revisit what we were doing and what the goal is. And maybe we overstepped a goal, or maybe not.
Maybe not. Maybe. I mean, we don't want it to take 5 years to grow up to the point where and get some benefit out of it. I think we want it to look good to start with so people can see it. We can't put little 1 gallon plants in. I understand that.
Yeah.
I think just a cost breakdown and some stuff would sure help us.
Yeah, we'd be happy to bring back more detail and get bring in both.
Great.
I think this discussion kind of focuses the fact that we're not going to get savings on the current design. Okay, we're reject all the bids and go through all that process and try to hope, you know, for save $20.38 on a rebid. I agree with you that given the clustering of the bids, it's not going to be a fruitful exercise. My concern that I initially expressed was that it sounded like we were basically telling designers that whatever, you know, just go dream away. And then when we got to actually go to bid on it, you know, we're sitting there with sticker shock.
I definitely understand the concern. I don't think that's how it was instructed. What we did do is go through a collaborative process, which, you know, in hindsight, you know, having multiple designers, you know, that was a specific thing that we wanted to do because we wanted to have the ability to promote in the community a designer you could go to if people wanted to. And rather than go to one designer with a very detailed scope, we collaborated, right? And maybe that resulted in, you know, something that is more grand of scale than it could have been. I really think the process worked well. We got some really good designs, and they're different designs. And with that process came some costs. And so that's where we're at. I think there are things in this garden that are different than your home, right? You've got benches and you've got kiosks. And so let us go through and present that aspect of it so that you get a better feeling for kind of those auxiliary, you know, things that wouldn't be in a, you know, home garden, for instance. A commercial scale park bench is not a cheap adventure. There's multiple ones of those in there. So
I don't want you and staff to go and chase something that, you know, I mean, if we're not going to be just telling us that park benches are expensive and putting that as a line item and breaking all these things down and ending up with over a third of $1 million still isn't going to change my concern that it's over a third of $1 million. And you can break it down all day long. You can get down to each individual plant. It won't help me. Okay, I'm just looking at, I'm going to continue to look at a half acre over a third of $1 million for just plants. And, you know, well, there's no building. There's
PG is not a conservator.
Yeah. So I don't want you to think that, at least as far as I'm concerned, that what I'm hearing you sort of say might be the way to come back. I doubt it's going to be of much value to me. Okay. So I just, if that's what you do, no, I don't want you to say that's what you wanted. No, I don't want that. I think that the, you know, my way forward would be to go back to the design phase. And I look at, you know, I've talked to, you know, folks, you know, designing houses and whatnot. You know, you sit at home and you design all this stuff, and the house gets big and it gets really elaborate and whatnot. Then you go to the guy that's going to design and build it, and you start cutting stuff back because
you see the price.
Yeah, once you see the price, all of a sudden, well, you know, maybe I can do with a 4-bedroom instead of a 10-bedroom house. So that's you.
I just have enough knowledge that when we take it to the floor, we can support it.
Yeah, so I'm looking right now at the cost estimate, and I can see that the total plant cost is about $97,600, which is, that gives you an idea of the plant cost component. The majority of these costs are kind of in these peripheral, you know, commercial grade kind of components, but, you know, so I don't know that it's a design, you know, necessarily the designers went off and did like the Titan, or maybe that's not the right one. They did the Queen Mary of gardens. I think that when you look at this, you've got other components. The drainage system is significant. The irrigation system is significant. That's $100,000 there. But again, I think we can put together these costs and show you, here's the mobilization work, here are the plant components, and kind of give you a breakdown of all those different costs so you can see. The signage, for example, by itself, is for the three signs that we have, or the two signs, is $52,000.
Wow. That's some pricey signage. I also that's would like to get... House cost.
$42,000, sorry.
Can we also get, I mean, unless everybody's going to drive there, can we get a picture of a person with a truck in all of this? Because it is literally twice the size of this room. It's not very big.
No, it's quite bigger than twice the size of that room, Director Gutzeit. It's a pretty sizable structure.
Okay, I'm gonna put my car on it because I go there. I was there today. It's small.
If you look at that concrete pad, that's big. That's the size of your like half of your driveway. That concrete pad that's on the plans, and that's just one corner of that section. So it's a sizable lot.
So you're not going to take a picture, so I'll go take a picture. Is that what you're saying? I'll take a picture and I'll bring it next time. Because it's small.
Make sure you're not there with your pickup truck. Use like a small car.
You know, would it be worthwhile on the 30th of this month, we're going to have a tour that we could take a few minutes and go by where the pocket park is?
Yeah, it's open.
It's going to be coming to the board.
It's right by the
and they're going to have the same concerns we have.
That's a good point.
We can try and work that in. I will talk to the chief of operations on that. I know Keith has got a strict itinerary, so I will try and arrange for that.
Just drive the bus across this park.
Yes.
My own picture.
So if it were a square, it would be 40 feet by 40 feet.
It's really not that big.
Yes.
It's about the size of a home lot.
It's 16,000 square
feet. I'm sorry, 16.
I was going to say, wait.
Minus.
Yeah, I think somebody said 16.
Well, I appreciate all the feedback. I think we've heard a lot. We'll get back with staff and we'll strategize and think about what we've heard and try and come back to the committee with something that's going to help us move forward. So I appreciate the feedback. I get the concerns and we'll take those to heart and we evaluate.
Thank you, staff. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
With that, we go move on to item five, which is presented by Matt Dickens again, along with Sarah Fleury, an update on the water operating plan and water conservation response actions. So whoever's going first, Matt, you up first?
I think it's me, so let me get my computer set up again here. I wonder if I can run audio from this. Let me see. Your sound. You guys should be able to see my screen. Can you see the screen okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you again, Chair Ford and members of the committee, Matt Dickens, Sustainability Manager, along with Sarah Fleury. We're going to present updates to the Water Operating Plan and Water Conservation Response actions. The overview of tonight's presentation will include the drought status, such as definitions of drought, which is a request that came in from the committee, California statewide drought status, and SCB drought status. We'll look at water supply updates, where Sarah Fleury will provide an overview of weather and reservoir forecasts, new operation strategies, 2022 operations, and 2023 operating plan forecast. And I'll conclude with water conservation updates specific to regulatory actions, water shortage contingency plan and ordinance actions, as well as our conservation performance. Okay, turning to drought status, we're going to look at drought definitions and then state and local drought statistics. So first thing first, when we look at drought, there is a kind of a common knowledge definition, which is provided here to the left. A drought is defined as a period of abnormally dry weather sufficiently prolonged for the lack of water to cause service, hydrologic imbalance in the affected area. And that's from the Glossary of Meteorology from 1959, shown here. However, there is a more elaborate model of drought depending on the time duration. And so you can see here, you've got meteorological drought, agricultural drought and hydrological drought, and then impacts from economic, social, and environmental, depending on the time duration of that climate variability. So in the meteorological drought, you've got precipitation deficiencies, you've got reduced infiltration, runoff, deep percolation, and groundwater recharge, high temperature, high winds, low relative humidity, ground cover, greater sunshine, less cloud cover. You've got increased evaporation and transpiration. So this is a meteorological drought, which is really talking about kind of the weather, precipitation, infiltration, runoff, those types of things, temperatures and evapotranspiration. In agricultural drought, as drought duration prolongs, you start seeing those climate variabilities in the meteorological drought impact soil water deficiency, plant water stress, reduced biomass and yield. That's an agricultural drought. So a drought, again, is based off of and kind of affects people differently. The next slide will have a video that I think explains this very well. A hydrological drought is, again, kind of duration prolonged, reduced stream flow, inflow reservoirs, lakes and ponds, reduced wetlands and wildlife habitat. The culmination of these activities over time have economic impacts, social impacts, and environmental impacts, also known as the triple bottom line for the sustainability folks out there. Okay, I'm going to play this here video. Can you guys hear the sound okay?
The U.S. Drought Monitor is a weekly snapshot of drought conditions across the United States. The purpose of the map is to show people where drought is occurring, its spatial extent and severity, and the time scale of the associated impacts. In the drought world, we say that drought is defined by those that it impacts. For example, those in the agricultural sector will have a different view of what drought is than those who deal in water supply. The USDM captures multiple types of drought on a single map. These include meteorological drought. Meteorological drought is determined by lack of precipitation and how conditions such as temperature and winds affect the amount of moisture. It is expressed in relation to the average conditions for a region. Meteorological drought is region-specific since precipitation is highly variable from region to region. For example, A location in Florida may receive more rainfall during a drought than a location in New Mexico receives during an entire year. Agricultural drought. This type of drought links the characteristics of meteorological drought to agriculture or landscapes. Agricultural drought focuses on precipitation shortages, evaporative demand, and soil moisture deficits. This type of drought is also dependent upon plant type, stage of growth, and soil properties. Hydrological drought. Hydrological drought is associated with the effects of rain and snow shortfalls on stream flow, reservoir and lake levels, and groundwater. Because it takes longer for precipitation deficiencies to show up in other components of the hydrological system, this type of drought can be out of phase with the other types of drought. Ecological drought. This type of drought results from prolonged and widespread deficit in naturally available water supplies that create multiple stresses across ecosystems. Socioeconomic drought. Socioeconomic drought includes the impact of drought on the economy related to supply and demand. While people typically think of agricultural products, drought can also affect hydroelectric energy generation, ethanol production, and numerous other items. In addition, drought impacts tourism, public health, infrastructure, and many other components of society. It's also important to note what the U.S. Drought Monitor isn't. The U.S. Drought Monitor is also not based solely on precipitation. The map analysis includes numerous indicators, drought impacts, and reports from over 400 expert observers around the country. It's not a computer model. Each week, a real person analyzes numerous types of drought-related data and draws the lines on the map based off the previous week's map. The Drought Monitor is also not a forecast of future conditions. It is based on available data for current conditions. Finally, the U.S. Drought Monitor is not a declaration of drought. Declarations are made by federal, state, and local agencies, which may or may not use the U.S. Drought Monitor to inform its decisions.
Okay, so now turning, interestingly enough, as we go through this process, I think there's a lot of linkage to how that video kind of explains drought and then the type of data that we're looking at when it comes to our supply and demand assessments and our conservation performance. Turning to the August, I should have an update on it. So I can't get it to change. Let's see here. Oh, here we go. Okay, so turning to September 6th, 2022, U.S. Drought Monitor for California, you can see that there are the state's still 100% in drought conditions. L.A. County, I'll explain that a little bit more. We are seeing some relief from Category D4 exceptional drought in the southeastern part of the state to severe drought. But nonetheless, 100% of the state is still experiencing drought, with the bulk of it in the category D2, which is severe drought. The bulk of the extreme drought through the center of the state and then in the lower Central Valley here, where we have exceptional drought conditions. Sarah provided this U.S. seasonal drought outlook, which shows us from September 1 through November 30th. We do have some drought tendency during the valid period. And according to this, as we can see here in most of California, except in the southeastern part of the state, the drought conditions are forecasted to persist based off of this assessment. When we turn to local weather statistics in the Santa Clara Valley, we are still kind of split along the 14, it looks like almost, but the valley split between D2 and D3 exceptional and severe drought conditions. Evapotranspiration year to date, or for the month, I should say, of August, was down 2.02% compared to 2020. Year to date, it's up 11%, which means that we typically would see irrigation demands increase by somewhat that number, plus or minus 5%. In precipitation, current month, we had no precipitation in August. Calendar year to date, we're down 77% compared to 2020. But water year to date, we're down 12% compared to that period and average. For that period. And for temperatures, the max air, average max air temperature was about half a degree hotter in 2022 for the month of August than it was in 2020. With that, I'll pass it over to Sarah for her update.
Thanks, Matt. Okay, we'll go to the next slide. So the first thing I wanted to show you is just the 1 month outlook for September, even though we're halfway through. You can see the precipitation forecasts on the left-hand side show California is mostly white there. With that means probability of equal chances of above or below average precipitation. The lower section where drought, where Matt had shown that drought relief was happening, you can see there's a little more green. So they're getting a little more rain from those atmospheric rivers, hurricanes, things like that. And then as you move to the right-hand side, you'll see that, you know, the entire state, the entire Southwest is basically dealing with above normal temperatures. Hopefully we've gotten through that for the month of September. Next slide, please. So as we move into next water year, which starts October 1st, we've been talking about having another La Nina year. Well, this will be the third La Nina year winter in a row, which they're calling the triple dip La Nina. And at least it's fun to say, if anything, but it's extremely rare. Occurs about every 20 to 22 years. So hopefully Matt and I will only experience this one time. But the La Nina year is going to be pushing, the Pacific jet stream basically pushes all the storms up north. Southern California tends to be warmer and drier. And that's kind of what they're predicting for this winter as well. We have had two other triple dip La Ninas since they started looking at La Nina and El Nino cycles. And the last two times, the third year, as we're coming into, were the 13th and 14th driest years for statewide water precipitation. So that, what that means is we're gonna expect around 70% of our average precipitation. But, you know, like other La Nina years, you never know, things could change and you know, weather can shift. So that's just kind of an outlook of what we're expecting, preparing for. Next slide. Looking at the 3 month outlook, this is October, November, December for precipitation and temperature. This is be reflective of that triple dip La Nina. So you've got on the precipitation side, most of California showing a probability of below normal precipitation. You can see actually down in the LA, Southern California area, it's actually white. So there may be a chance that we get more than, more close to normal. You never know. So that's promising. And with regards to temperature, again, we're going to expect above normal temperatures throughout California again. Next slide. So I wanted to quickly review kind of what San Luis Reservoir storage is looking like and how it has looked throughout this drought. So we're kind of finishing up the third year of this drought. And so this big, the largest graphic here shows us a comparison of the historical average in turquoise. You've got the 1920 in red at the top there, which basically was an average year. Moving into last year, 2020-2021 water year, you can see, unfortunately, we ended the year down here at some pretty low levels for San Luis Reservoir, which unfortunately had us starting at a really low level, but we were able to recover with similar conditions. And you can see that we're starting out next year in a much better place than we did last year. So we're seeing that being reflective throughout a few of the larger reservoirs, which is good. And it's because of all the conservation that's been happening, the states being very conservative, not knowing what conditions are going to be like year to year, and just trying to stay ahead of this. On the upper right-hand side, you can see that the San Luis Reservoir is split between the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and DWR, and so it shows the different shares of water in the reservoir. DWR is the dark color, and USBR is the lighter turquoise. And then at the bottom right-hand corner, that one shows us the different colors of water, the different types of water stored in the DWR or State Water Project portion. So you've got dead pool water at the bottom, some backed up water in orange, and then carryover supplies in green. And then you've got the actual DWR portion above that with the purple dotted line. And so I'm going to go into a little more detail about where SCB Water's portions are in this reservoir. But we have a little bit of everything. So next slide. So I wanted to mention and kind of talk about some new operation strategies that we've been trying the last couple years. As we've gone through the last drought and moving forward, we're recognizing that carryover supply has become a real critical water resource to have in our back pocket. Reason being is that it's stored in San Luis Reservoir. You can get it very easily like Table A, so it's a good source to have, and you can get a lot of it if you need it in the summer and those peak months. It's basically unused Table A from previous years that gets rolled over into the next year. And we found that it's really advantageous to have anywhere from 10 to 15,000 acre feet a year available to help reduce risks of shortages, provides a little bit of extra security and cushion for unknown challenges that could arise from year to year. But it's difficult to sustain this through multiple critical dry years. So I've created a graphic here to kind of go through how we've done that, which shows you our carryover supplies each year from 2020 into next year. And that's in blue. And then in green, it shows us the San Luis Reservoir backup storage. And so what we've realized in the last couple of years is since the reservoirs have been so low because we've been having such terrible drought conditions, we've kind of created a strategy where we're trying to conserve our carryover storage and lean more heavily on our bank supplies. When we don't need to utilize all those bank supplies, we've actually found that we can back that supply up in the San Luis Reservoir. So it makes it easier to access, and it's been helpful in kind of keeping that 10 to 15,000 acre feet of cushion, I guess, available. And so really in the end, it's like one big bucket and we can get it when we need it, but I've broken it up here and kind of wanted to walk through quickly of how we've been operating. So in 2020, that was our first year where we had to shut down all of our alluvial wells for PFAS. So we lost about half of our capacity that year. And in addition, we had a 20% allocation. So it was the beginning of a drought, it's pretty dry conditions. We only had 9,000 acre feet of carryover to start the year, which isn't really in that sweet spot. So we really wanted to be careful that year. So in 2020, what we did was we leaned very heavily on the water exchanges that we had available, and we also utilized banking supplies. And so by 2021, at the beginning of the year, you can see our carryover supply increased because we didn't have to use all the Table A water from our allocation. And so it got rolled over into 2021. So we were at our sweet spot. 2021 then turns out to be a pretty terrible and critically dry year. 5% allocations. We did have some of our NWells come back online that year, but it was still an extremely challenging year. We did have to utilize carryover, but we continued to maximize our bank supplies and were able by 2022, not only have conserves carry a decent amount of carryover supply, but also back up some of that banked water into the San Luis Reservoir. And so you can see that we stayed within that sweet spot. This year in 2022, we're following that same procedure. We're trying to get as much bank water as we can out of the ground because it's competitive and it's hard to get what you need each month. And we're storing that. And so at the beginning of 2023, knowing that we could potentially be going into more dry conditions, I'm estimating that we're going to have a pretty good supply of carryover and backup storage in San Luis Reservoir to kind of help us if conditions continue to worsen. Next slide, please. And so this is a graphic that's shown in the Water Resources staff report every month. I update it. You've got the dotted line there, which shows the Water Resources estimated monthly demands. And then you've got the bar graph, which is extremely colorful in drought years, which shows us what supplies we're utilizing each month to meet those demands. You can see, I guess, some things to point out. One thing is that around May, we started really seeing the conservation come into play. And you can see there's the gap is getting bigger between the bar graph and the dotted line, which means that's all water that is imported supply that can be conserved for another year. And so that's kind of where that backup water comes into play. We can save that water, it's available. Another thing to note is that we've been pulling banked water supply all year. The orange is representative of our Rosedale Rio Bravo banking program. And you can see we were taking water straight from the beginning of January. Our semi-tropic storage is in gray. And as you can see, we get a lot less from them each month. And so that's kind of where, when you get into those peak months, if we did have to meet demands all the way to the dotted line, we would be using our carryover and our Table A supply to meet those demands because we're pulling as much as we can from our banking program. And so that's where that water comes into play. Next slide, please. Lastly, I wanted to show you an operating plan that I put together. We're not quite to the point where we're looking at all the different scenarios for 2023, but what we have been looking at since I, keep this updated pretty frequently is worst case scenario. So this is kind of one of those worst case scenario operating plans where we're looking at where we are now in 2022 at a 5% allocation. And if we continue in 2023 with a 5% allocation and even move into 2024 with a 5% allocation, what is that going to look like with regards to our operating plan? So I wanted to run through this, and this is all preliminary estimates, but I think it'll give you a good idea of where we're at. And so we're going to start at the top where we see demands. For our demands, we're estimating about a 2% increase per year. That's pretty standard. As we move down the row, you can see you've got alluvial and saga supplies. From 2022 to the blue column to the orange column, you can see that that alluvial and the saga supplies actually grow. And so that's indicative of our rehabbed wells coming back online and giving us more local supply. You've also got a little bit of recycled water increase. That's going a little slower than we thought in the urban plan, but it is still expected to go up and it helps out as well. So when you get to the imported demand line item, you can see that our imported demand goes from almost 48,000 acre feet in 2022, and it actually drops as we go to 2024. And that's because we've got more local supplies to meet those demands. So technically, things should be getting easier for us as we move out to 20. Table A water stays the same at 5% allocation across the board. Our BVRRB is 11,000 acre feet firm every single year, and that is, we get that no matter what. And then you can see we've got our excess imported supplies in red. And again, the opposite of the imported demand, we need less dry year water supplies as we move out to 2024. We've got our carryover supply next. And I've, these are estimates of what we're going to have moving forward. You've got our Rosedale banking program. We will be able to get 20,000 acre feet out of that program this year. Next year, we estimate at least 15,000 acre feet of firm supply because we have the Irvine Ranch short-term agreement. And then in 2024, our firm supply from Rosedale is 10,000 acre feet. And, we may be able to get more that year, but this is what we can guarantee at this time we can get. So as conditions change, things may change as well. Semi-tropic bank is 5,000 acre feet. That's our maximum amount across the board for each year. And then you've got our Yuba Accord supply, which we have available until 2025. So the 675 acre feet is representative of what we will actually get this year. And then moving forward, we estimate about 1,000 acre feet each year moving forward. You'll notice that for the flexible storage line item, we don't estimate that we're going to need that. So we will have 6,000 acre feet in Castaic Lake if there is a need for more local supplies during some kind of emergency. So that's also good to have in our back pocket. And then we have a green row that I've allocated water for stage two conservation demand reduction. So with the stage two conservation, we estimate anywhere from 10 to 20% reduction of our demands. And you can see how that works out around 10,000 acre feet each year, and it grows as our demands grow. I've estimated 15% just to kind of average it out. But that's a real important component. Without that, you can move to the bottom row, which is where we would land with our extra carryover supplies moving to next year. And without that conservation, that drops all of our carryover supplies that are our cushion down, 10,000 acre feet. So the conservation is a really important piece. And in this operating plan, I'm making the assumption, and this is, of course, a decision made by people above me, but if we continue with 5% allocations, we hope that the conservation programs will continue to bring this kind of demand reduction in those conditions, because they've been real critical in helping us provide that benefit of carryover storage and cushion just in case things happen as we don't know. And that's all I have. And I'll answer questions, I guess, at the end of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. All right, now we'll turn to regulatory updates and the water shortage contingency plan. We've gone through this before, but currently we are, the entire state is under a drought emergency declaration from the governor. The governor has asked all Californians to reduce their water consumption by 15% compared to 2020's levels. In addition to that, the State Water Resources Control Board has taken action on January 4th and in May to require emergency regulations, including the prohibition of water waste activities, the requirement that all of our stage two measures are implemented, the banning of non-functional turf, and as well as a specific components that impact HOAs and their enforcement of CCNRs. In addition to that, the SCV Water Board of Directors adopted stage two of the water shortage contingency plan and ordinance in April of this year. The water shortage contingency plan is comprised of these six components in order to achieve a 20% voluntary conservation. Those include drought sustainable actions, deploying supply augmentation, which Sarah mentioned before, drought programs, messaging and outreach, engagement, and restrictions and additional measures, which are implemented in our ordinance. We have lots of conservation programs, very robust, diverse portfolio to help our customers conserve water, ranging from lawn replacement rebates to education classes and all of the stuff in between. We also have water waste restrictions, those common water waste activities. These focus on reducing water consumption by prohibiting and restricting those water waste activities, in which case these activities tend and do not provide customers any beneficial use. We also have day watering restrictions to 3 days per week. And we encourage folks to do 2 5-minute cycles. Well, actually, that's required. And we ask people to water in the morning and the evening to avoid evaporation losses. And again, I've mentioned this before, but on the non-functional turf, we are launching and have initiated our engagement and education campaign for commercial, industrial, institution customers, homeowner associations, and common interest developments to identify ways to turn off non-functional turf areas, cap non-functional turf areas if they can, or convert it. So we have turn it off, cap it, or convert it. Again, this talks more about our enforcement capabilities. The State Water Resources Control Board has asked that, it did not mandate that water agencies or jurisdictions, local jurisdictions and authorities enforce the state ban, but they wanted and certainly expected the communication of that to customers, and SCV Water is communicating that and reserves and retains the option to enforce should that be merited or warranted by the agency. All right, turning now to SCV Water demand performance, we'll look at normal conservation target performance. That's compared to our gallon per capita day continuation from SBX 7-7, our drought conservation target, which is 15% of 2020's levels, and then how we're performing compared to statewide and regional drought performance. For the interim conservation target, this chart shows us similar to what Sarah showed, but a little more of a conservation framework. Essentially, what we're trying to do is get 2% in gallons per capita day reduction at today's population compared to what we established in SBX 7-7 in 2010, essentially, which was 274 gallons per capita day. And so this would be an additional 2% reduction in GPCD. That's what the dotted line is today's population and what we would expect to see consumption at various different months. The baseline GPCD is the dashed line up above. That's kind of what we used to use in those gallon per capita day estimates from 2010. As you can see, the year's been kind of up and down, but since May, when the agency declared a stage two, as well as we saw a proliferation of media and coverage regionally and locally and statewide, specific to the drought and the drought emergency. But shortly after the agency adopted stage two in April, we're starting to see the delta between the conservation pick up. Compared to our normal conservation targets, we're down 6.9%. We're below what we wanted to save as 2% GPCD by 6.9%, or an additional 3,195 acre feet. However, we do report to the State Water Resources Control Board the comparison, monthly production comparison to 2020. So this chart shows us the 15% reduction voluntary conservation target that the governor proclaimed last July. The blue bar is 2020 production, the brown bar is 2022 production, and the dashed line is 15% of 2020. As you can see, early in the year, in February, March, and April, in 2020, we had rain. That's why this crater exists. But our usage was significantly higher because we had the hottest, driest record, hottest and driest weather conditions on record. And so we're comparing a wet year to a dry year here. But since May, we're starting to see consumption in 2022 drop compared to 2020. Yet we have not achieved the 15% target to date. This chart is a statistical chart that shows us percentage of compared to the month compared to 2020. And it also shows us during the governor's 15% voluntary conservation call period. I would draw your attention to the right-hand side. The blue line is monthly difference in consumption compared to 2020 or production. And then the orange is cumulative. And look what's happened since May. We went from wild swings of 161%, 140% in March and April to 95.8% of 2020, 92.1, 91.3, 89.9. So we almost broke into the lower echelons of the stage two 11% target. We're trying to get 11 to 20% target. We're currently in August at 10.1%. So we're continuing to gain traction in conservation, which is significant to understand considering that you have very different usage profiles and some different operational demands that are occurring this year compared to 2020. So this is pretty impressive that the community is continuing to conserve at this level and at those levels conservation is increasing. Cumulatively, we're still about 0.5% over 2020's levels. This chart shows similar data in table format. And we can compare it to what the State Water Resources Control Board provides us in its assessment based off of the hydrologic regions and statewide performance. In July, South Coast was 8.6% below 2020. For us, we were 8.7. So we slightly outperformed the South Coast region. However, cumulatively, they were down 1.3%. All South Coast region water agencies were up 1.6% in July. However, the state was down 10.4%, so we underperformed relative to the state, and we also underperformed cumulatively. But in August, we're continuing to see conservation gains from 8.7% to 10.1%, and a drop in cumulative from 1.6% over to 0.5% over. Okay, so in conclusion, actions and next steps. In September, we have our non-functional turf ban outreach effort, which is continuing, and we will launch that effort, educate and provide education and engagement to the CII, HOA, and DIM customers, as well as follow-up and support. We have completed our drought-ready videos and preparing those for launch and release. We are preparing SCV Community Conservation in Action to share case stories from residential, commercial, landscape customers who are saving water so we can showcase how folks are saving water and share some successes in the community. We're also promoting our lawn replacement program priorities. Fall is a great time to plant your plants as well as spring. So now we're getting into the promotion of lawn replacement and trying to get those landscapes installed during the cooler season and winter season to take advantage of those attributes. And then we have continued performance monitoring and adaptive management. In conclusion and summary, drought conditions persist. We have a third La Nina year forecasted. Statewide drought emergency is in effect. State Water Resources Control Board emergency regulations are in effect. The State Water Project allocation was at 5% for the second consecutive year. We have continued use of critical dry year supplies. SCV Water conducted a stage two and implemented stage two of its water shortage contingency plan and ordinance. Clearly, without conservation, storage and banking recovery are prolonged. As Sarah showed, we're not looking at a shortage, but we're definitely looking at without conservation, less water for carryover opportunities and banking storage opportunities. And then for current conservation performance is currently below target, but it's trending down. I reviewed our performance interim through September 12th, and for the first 12 days of September, we are down 15.3%. So we are continuing to see conservation, even though we had that dry, hot period followed by rains. I think customers are continuing to conserve water. And we may, if this holds, we're going to break into that 15% conservation performance target this month. With that, I would be happy, as Sarah is, as I'm sure, to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah and Matt. I have no cards on this particular item. Any, anybody online?
No, there is none.
Thank you. So on item number five, questions from members of the committee. Director Cooper.
Just a quick one for Sarah. Should the allocation this next year go to zero, which is highly likely, where would you draw that from? Would you just pull that more from the Saugus to make up for that?
That's a good question. I'm going to be putting those numbers together probably next week. And then I expect in October or November, I'll have those estimates. I think that we would definitely utilize the 15,000 acre feet from Rosedale, try to get 20 if we could. You know, we should have a healthy supply of carryover. And
does it look like in 2024 you were going to pull an extra 4,000 out of the Saugus? Maybe you just have to pull that out a year earlier or something.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with the Saugus wells that are available. So this is all based on what's going to be available. And I don't think we could try to pull out as much as we can, but we're constrained with our straws as well in the ground. So I think it would be a little bit from everywhere. And, you know, again, conservation. I think one of the things in 2022 to consider is that the conservation efforts were there at the beginning of the year, but we had so much rain and things didn't really see that big effort until the summer started, which has been very helpful. So I think as we move into another year, if it is a 0% allocation, I'm hoping the community will help more. And, you know, we'll pull as much as we can from our local and our imported supplies that we have. And luckily, we should have a good cushion. We have flexible storage if we need it in those summer months, and hope for maybe 1 month with some decent rain to cut those demands back.
Yeah, the way that the third year of La Nina is sounding, it may be that they just do health and safety water for next year and cut the rest of us to zero. So maybe November, December, or whenever, we got to kind of look at that number and see what it's going to be if it's zero.
I will. Yep. I will have that information for you. And I, they are asking for health and safety. Our agency won't qualify for health and safety because we have plenty of local supplies to meet those needs. So
yeah,
we wouldn't get any of that water.
And maybe you'll just have good news come November, December.
Maybe I'll have good news. It's been quite a few years of bad news. I look forward to that.
Director Gutze.
Well, thanks to Director Cooper for putting a snub on the good news that you had, because I thought that was a great table that you showed, Sarah, like how we're going to accomplish this into future years. One question, I don't know who wants to answer, I have two questions, but one on the La Nina issue. I remember going to a session at Aqua once where they talked about it's their theory was that it's really the jet stream and those atmospheric rivers more than the La Nina, La Nino situation. Is it correct to say that La Nina isn't necessarily the only driver of whether we get rain or not? Because I think that their theory was that atmospheric river might be separate from La Nina. Is that correctly?
The atmospheric rivers are extremely important, especially in California. That's where we tend to get a majority of our water from, is one or two pretty good atmospheric rivers. I think historically La Nina years just tend to keep Southern California dry, and the weather gets pushed north. And so those atmospheric rivers get pushed to Oregon and Washington where they don't benefit us. But ironically, there's been plenty of years where La Nina, you get hit with lots of atmospheric rivers and they hit, Central California, Southern California. So it's really a shot in the dark, I think. I mean, the climatologists say these are their best estimates, based on historic information. Yeah. As we know, that's changing every year. So this La Nina year could be a wet year, and it could just be one of those La Ninas that's out of the ordinary. El Nino. El Nino tends to bring more rain, and it could be dry. So
right. I actually have a hat that says like drought. I'm sorry, storm watch, whatever year, and it didn't even rain. Like much at all. That's what I remembered. And then, so fingers crossed that we get some rain, regardless of what we call it. And then for Matt, the non-functional turf, I saw the letters go out, and that's, pretty recent. Do we have an estimate on what impact, like on valley-wide conservation, it would be if that is implemented? Because I would think, that's a lot of grass coming offline if fully implemented. Do we know how much that would help us?
Director Goodsight, thank you for that question. At this point in time, I do not have any empirical data to show what the magnitude of the non-functional turf is. Our estimates suggest that the way that typically these engagement efforts work, we already have some customers who have turned down. I think if you look around the complex that you're at tonight, you'll see some non-functional turf areas that are turned off, particularly one near my door of my office. But throughout the community, you'll see that as well. So there's probably about 5 to 10% of customers who have already started taking action before we launched the engagement initiative. We're hoping that we could get, 2-3 times that with this initiative, particularly because we're educating and engaging. But it's something we're going to have to continue to have active engagement with the community. I'm thinking that we could get 2-3% additional savings by this effort, but I don't have any good estimate in terms of the true magnitude of non-functional turf valley-wide.
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to be a big benefit when implemented. And I continue to hope that those places are better equipped to, implement conservation because they may have landscapers, they may have a groundskeeper or somebody in charge of it, so higher area and like a better point of contact than trying to reach 350,000 homeowners and getting them to do something, So I'm hopeful that that will help a lot. So thank you.
Other questions from members? Director Colley.
Yeah, I want to make sure I understand when we're going to require, or the state has required CII customers to turn off irrigation to non-functional turf. And we're also telling those same customers that, by the way, we're willing to help you fund the lion's share of transitioning that non-functional turf to something else, right? Okay. My difficulty with that is that when over the last quite a few years, we've been telling customers that we would like you to consider transitioning non-functional turf to drought-tolerant stuff. We understood at the time that that's going to cause a temporary increase as that new landscaping becomes, it needs to mature, so you need to put more water on it. But we absorbed, you know, we absorbed that cost and we helped them and whatnot. I don't fully understand why today, when they have to, they decided against taking us up on it when it was a carrot approach. Now the state has implemented the stick approach. I don't fully understand why we would want to continue to have everybody pay for the carrot when the carrot was turned down in the past quite a few years. So my inclination is to, you know, if you now have to because the state says so, okay, do it. There's no reason at all that I can see that the rest of the customers of the agency ought to be funding that transition, which also causes a temporary increase of water use. It actually is, to do it now is somewhat counterproductive. It's productive for the long run, but not for this drought. So I would like to see us cut back. If you are required by the state to do something, I would no longer want to incentivize or pay the lion's share of doing what the state requires. Because somebody has to pay for that. Okay, that's not free money. That's money from other customers. That's money from the same people who did it years ago and did the right thing 4 or 5 years ago, that they took us up on the lawn replacement. So that's my point of view.
Director Cawley, thank you for sharing that insight. A couple of points of clarification. While that perspective of funding requirements is certainly merits debate and thinking as far from a policy perspective, a couple of points of clarification. One, the term non-functional turf is relatively new. And that is one that came up as a component of regulation as new as Southern Nevada Water Authority late last year and the State Water Resource Control Board in May. So that's one component. The non-functional turf is a new, relatively new definition in terms of this policy. The second piece is that customers, while they're required to turn the irrigation off, they're not required to convert it. So the state ban is roughly for 1 year as it stands. It could be extended, it could be lifted. So many customers may try to weather the storm to avoid having to convert and reseed and replant later on. So there is an opportunity. In addition to that, I think that the state action was preemptive in the sense that many of our customers have not had an opportunity to plan for this specific requirement, to budget for the requirement, and may not have great direction in terms of where to go from here. So there's a compelling interest for the agency to continue to engage and guide and support better outcomes for our customers. The last thing I would point out in terms of the replanting or the establishment water, we have to remember that while the establishment water is higher relative to the base need of that drought-tolerant landscape, the aggregate is significantly lower than the water that we use for the turf area. So it's important to note that even though you change the calculus turf requires 6 to 8 feet of water per year to maintain. You reduce that to 3 feet per year, even if you increase it by 25%, you're going up to 3 to 4 feet per year, which still has an aggregate reduction compared to turf as it stands. So there, we have to put it in context that you're changing the calculus. So it's, you know, yes, it's more water relative to what that plant will need in the future, but it's way less than what the current establishment of the required water requirement of turf is. So I think those are four components that simple that come into the strategy to say we're doing well to educate and support our customers to help develop better outcomes, more sustainable outcomes, because this was relatively new, different, and something that not many people had an opportunity to plan for, specific to non-functional turf.
Can I?
Yes.
Okay. So, all right. So I understand and I appreciate your clarification, the education that the replacement plantings still would not require on a weekly basis more water than the turf that got torn out. So there would be an immediate savings, is what you're saying, compared to continuing to water the turf. All right.
Yeah.
And that's a valid point. Got it. The point that the definition is new holds. No, I don't see that matters, okay? Because anybody could have 5 years ago looked at a particular piece of grass and said that doesn't need to be grass, okay? No matter what you call it, it doesn't matter. So the argument that we have a new definition that the regulators came up with, to me, is it doesn't matter. So as a minimum, I would like to see us figure out what the incentive needs to be, rather than paying the lion's share, rather than paying what we're offering right now. I'd at least like to consider, maybe, you know, what do we need to incentivize them to replace it now with something which, when the drought ends, will carry on and hopefully be there for the next drought. All right, that's really what you're saying, I think, is the goal. And so when you talk about education, absolutely, have not advocated in any way, shape, or form that we cut our education budget. But my thinking is still that it doesn't make any sense to me to pay, you know, my understanding is basically it becomes very inexpensive for the business or the HOA or whomever to replace non-functional turf if we're paying the lion's share of that bill. So that's what I would prefer, to have some policy discussions aimed at figuring out how we can provide sufficient incentive to do what you're saying would be beneficial, and I agree, rather than what are we currently doing, which I think is far too generous. And again, I'm going to stress that our generosity is not, you know, the folks at this table pulling out our wallets to, you know, help these folks. Okay. This is money we're extracting at the, you know, from folks that, you know, you either pay us or you have no, you know, the most valuable resource to your life is taken away from you. Okay. You simply can't live without this water. And so we threaten to take that away if you don't pay us. And I think that those customers deserve to be thought of in this whole process. And we should not be taking more money than we need to in order to incentivize the behavior we're trying to get from CII customers. So I'd like to see us have a policy discussion of, you know, how do we curtail our lawn replacement for those customers that are now going to have to do it anyway.
Chair Ford, just one thing. I'm going to do a little bit of a time check here. We're having a lot of robust discussion tonight. I think we're happy to have policy discussion on these items. It's the committee's interest in doing that. We do have another heavy lift presentation to go. Yes, I just want you to be aware as we're going through. Let's just think of that.
All right. Oh, that's my okay. I'm done. Thank you, though.
Thank you.
Director Armitage?
Well, to follow up really quickly on what you said, I know that we've applied for grant funding for some of these types of projects in the future. I don't recall, and I guess I was just going to ask, I don't recall if we're currently using some grant funding so that it's not coming. Okay, no. But in the future, I know we've applied, so I don't know if that changes the conversation when we have it. So it's not coming out of current budget, but it's already budgeted for grant funding coming through for that. So I just wanted to throw that in. That's it.
No other further
thank
questions?
Thank you.
For Matt, Sarah, thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
And with that, we move on to item 6.1 to be presented by Sarah Fleury on the status of water supply and water banking programs. Item 6.2, presented by Nadja Pitois, update on water resiliency plan initiative activities. If I pronounce the name right, thank you.
You did great.
Good evening.
Hi.
I hope this won't take too much time. I'll try. But can you see my presentation?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. So I will be giving an update on the Watershed Resilience Initiative.
Nadja, do you have your presentation and speaker note? Do you want to change your setting?
Yeah, how do I?
So you need to go back to where you were.
Okay.
Yeah, and then you see on the very top where it says show taskbar display setting. Go to the display setting in the middle. Scroll down.
Uh-huh.
Swap that, right?
Okay, thank you. All right, so now it's better?
Yep, you're good to go.
All right, perfect, thanks. All right, so the presentation will cover the drivers of the initiative, just a reminder of, what led to this. The basin setting, and then a summary of the work plan that we've been working on for the past few months. Then status of work in progress, and finally, future planned activities. So California is facing unprecedented challenges in water supply, protection of natural ecosystems, and balancing the needs of diverse water users. The Water Resilience Initiative addresses all of these challenges with the goal of providing a transparent and scientifically sound evaluation of costs, benefits, and understanding of the complex interrelated actions. There are many drivers of the Watershed Resilience Initiative, such as the California Water Plan update, protection and enhancement of environmental qualities, and water use efficiency mandates. So this initiative incorporates agency mission and values such as environmental sensitivity, reliability, and cost effectiveness. It also integrates the agency's environmental stewardship objectives along the river, such as providing environmental values in the river through various means listed in the slide.
Just
Regulatory and legal actions are another set of drivers for the resilience initiative. The initiative itself represents a revised planning methodology that evaluates many sources of uncertainties, such as future climate, contaminants of emerging concern, permitting, and ratepayer implications. There will be engagement with the many stakeholders that have a stake in the watershed and its resources. And the initiative strives to make SCB Water an institutional leader for public policy choices along the river. So moving on to the basin settings, the Santa Clarita Valley watershed is a very complex human natural system. SCV has an elaborate portfolio of imported supplies as well as local supplies, the main one being groundwater. Actions taken in the groundwater basin impact the ecosystem and overall supply reliability. You can see in the illustration on the right the interdependencies of the three main water supply systems that we're studying, the three main systems. So the water supply system, the groundwater system, and the ecosystem. And this diagram attempts to visualize all the impacts and constraints that impact each of these three systems, as well as their interdependencies. We tried to capture all these processes in three primary analytical tools used in this initiative. And these are the water resource integration model, the ecological system model, and the groundwater system model. And so this diagram now tries to show conceptually the three main models that I just mentioned, the processes they model and the data inputs and outputs and the interaction between them. While we don't have water quality explicitly in one, in a model, we are reviewing water quality data and modeling to incorporate them as part of the planning process. And finally, this is a stakeholder-driven initiative. We anticipate many entry points for stakeholder input. And I think Steve mentioned earlier, we are still working on the form and specific roles of the stakeholder groups. So we have these three types of stakeholder groups that we envision, that we will be refining them and giving them more definition. So next is the summary of the draft work plan. We've divided or organized the initiative into three main phases. In phase A, the goal of phase A is to understand existing conditions and the adequacy and limitations of our analytical tools. In phase B, we put our different systems, such as the groundwater system or the supply portfolio, under different stress tests to understand their vulnerabilities to future stressors or uncertainties. So if we were to change precipitation, how would the system behave in the future? Or if we were to increase growth, how would reliability of our water supply change? So in that assessment, we're agnostic to what level of uncertainty we're planning for. We just want to understand the behavior of the system. And then in phase C, we quantitatively evaluate the impact of adaptation strategies at mitigating the effect of future stressors. So I'll go in a bit more detail in the next slides. So each phase has three steps, and they're designed, structured in a way that is easy and logical to follow what analysis is being done and be able to communicate this to the, to the board and the stakeholders. So in phase A, we want to better understand our system and knowledge and data gaps. The goal is to develop a common knowledge of the current situation. And through the stakeholder process, we want to define uncertainties and future scenarios that we should evaluate. I've mentioned several times how we are planning under uncertainty, and there are generally three approaches for long-term planning under uncertainty, especially as it relates to climate. So in traditional decision analysis, we assume climate stationarity with the idea that natural systems fluctuate with an unchanging envelope of variability. Emphasis is put on predicting and then acting or responding. In the top-down or climate science approach, a sample or ensemble of climate projections is used as the future and then the performance of a system is predicted, and the vulnerabilities and strategies are identified. And then in the bottom-up or decision scale, the challenge with the top-down approach is that you are left with many questions because of the hundreds of global climate projections. And some of these questions could be, did the analysis cover the full range of uncertainties to be prepared? Would results be different if a different set of projections or method were used? And how likely is the future and what is the risk? So the bottom-up or decision scaling approach tries to eliminate that uncertainty that you get by selecting one future projection for each uncertain variable. It's essentially a stress test approach where a system is subjected to a range of future stressors to understand system vulnerabilities and when they may occur. Projections of uncertainty are then incorporated to assess the risk of unacceptable outcomes. And finally, adaptation strategies are developed based on decisions made toward what is most likely and or most acceptable. So in phase B is where we perform the vulnerability assessments. Each water sector of interest will undergo stress tests to determine its sensitivity to different future stressors. So for instance, the groundwater basin with increased pumping, we want to see its behavior, what happens to the groundwater table level, and then how does that impact GDEs? So we, to determine what, there are many, what we call water sectors of interest. So I mentioned groundwater, but we could have the ecosystem, municipal water supply, stakeholders. These are just examples of water sectors that we would study or put under a stress test. And then the blue boxes show performance indicators of interest. And the water sectors and the performance indicators will be selected through the stakeholder engagement process. We would provide a list and ask for feedback. So it's not, we try to just include everyone's concerns and interests. So this graph here is an example of how we would conduct a stress test. On the vertical axis is the water sector, and here it's the, as an example, the municipal water supply. On the horizontal axis is the stressor, and here we're using population as an example. And then the performance that we're looking at is reliability. So percent of time that our system performs within a certain desired reliability. So if you see as population increases, you can see that we are able to maintain desired performance up until a certain point, and after which the performance starts to decrease. So this is an example of how we're just trying to see with different levels of uncertainty what happens to the system. And based on that, we would then select adaptation strategies that cover a range of policy, management, and infrastructure options to see how these adaptation strategies can mitigate some of the impacts of these future stressors. So this table is an example. Again, will be developed through the stakeholder engagement process. And it shows different adaptation strategies that we could study. So for instance, local groundwater could be reoperated with new groundwater pumping profiles or new we can have new recharge and extraction facilities. Another example is implementing water use efficiency standards. And then another one could be a program to plant trees along sensitive reaches of the Santa Clara River. In this step of the phase, we are just evaluating adaptation strategies. We haven't, as an agency, we haven't selected which ones we are going to actually implement or build. So this next slide, I'll probably spend the most time on because it puts all the work together, all the work we're doing under this resilience initiative. In a way where we can start understanding our system, the benefits of different adaptation strategies, and how we wrap, how we, embrace uncertainty in our planning. So again, I'm using municipal water supply as an example, with the performance metric being supply reliability, and the stressor is population. And here, it would be a policy decision to select a desired performance. And in this example, I use 95%. So we want to be 95% of the time reliable over our planning horizon. And again, that curve just shows if we have no adaptation in place, we see that after a certain time into the future, the performance and supply reliability begins to decrease. If we implement an adaptation measure, such as here, adaptation A, you can see that the desired performance is extended over time, and the overall performance in the future is improved. Still doesn't meet our desired performance goals, but it's better than no adaptation. And so another, with each adaptation measure, you can improve your system performance. So next, the question is, well, what do we design for? We don't know if, population growth stops here, closer to the left end of the horizontal axis, or will it be somewhere here? So this is where, again, through the engagement process, we will identify plausible future states. And this is really a policy decision. And here in this example, I'm just showing if we were to overlay 2040, 2070, and 2100 projection distributions, you can see that you have a wide spread. And just focusing on the 2040 projection, if we were to take the median value as the value that we plan for in the future, and imagine a vertical line extending down, you can see that it intersects with the adaptation A, meaning that if you implement adaptation A, by 2040, you will be able to maintain that desired performance. But someone might be more risk, you know, more conservative and look at the more extreme end of the distribution, let's say here, sorry. And if you were to extend that line again down, you can see where it intersects the pink adaptation A curve, you no longer are able to maintain or meet that desired performance. You would need to implement adaptation B. So finally, you know, this is done for one, this graph here is showing one water sector, but, you know, we're going to have a long list of sectors. So how do you now compare the trade-offs in performance between these sectors? And here we provide a sample visualization of how we could plot trade-offs between different adaptation strategies. I won't go into detail, but the black octagon, the black line would be your desired performance. And then the shaded curve shows the deviation from your desired performance for each water sector. So here I have, again, just some examples of what these water sectors may be. And so if the shaded area is outside that black line or black shape, then it means you have increased risk of not meeting your desired performance in the future. And if it's inside the line, then it means you are meeting your performance objectives or even exceeding these objectives. And so the idea would be to get this curve to really, you know, the shaded area to at least intersect with or be within the bounds of that black line. And I just show two examples here where, you know, adaptation A, you can see some sectors perform well, but most don't. And then with adaptation B, you see improvements in almost all the sectors. And we're hoping that this is what will facilitate, you know, important policy decisions that the agency will take. You know, one other thing with these graphs and the stress tests is that even if the future unfolds in a way we weren't expecting, we will have information and knowledge in understanding what our system vulnerabilities are, and we'll be better able to react and implement different adaptation strategies. So moving on to the status of what's been done to date, our consultants have made progress on the California Environmental Flows Framework process. LIDAR has been flown and images are currently being processed, and the habitat suitability model is under development. We also have a draft work plan out, and that's been shared with all the pre-qualified consultants. We've put together a very rough draft of a schedule where that shows where we might have engagement, you know, engagement events. The goal is to not go beyond 6 months without a meeting, but we're also, you know, we're going to adapt and open to suggestions of the board wants more updates or interested in a certain topic, then we're happy to present. But this just gives an idea how we're looking at this initiative. And then finally, for future work, we will be issuing RFPs in the next couple of months to advance several tasks. And these may include evaluation of new groundwater operating profiles, groundwater monitoring and testing plans to support the evaluation of these new groundwater operating profiles, data management and stakeholder engagement support. The agency is also beginning to hire key staff to develop and manage the resilience initiative, as well as the models associated with the work. And additional staff will be added to have internal expertise to run and further develop these models. In the near term, we're relying on consultants to assist in the development of some of these models as the agency works on staffing. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Najwa. Any public comment online?
There is none.
Thank you. Comments from the committee on item 6.2. Richard Gutzer.
Can you remind me of the budget for this project, all in? Has it, you know, do we approve like X amount of dollars for this?
I will let Derek or Steve respond to that. Yeah.
Yes, part of the budget. Well, it's good. And I think it's about, let's say, $600,000 to $700,000 this school year. That's as far as we had projected out, I was really need to go back and look at the source information.
But that's everything like, well, yeah, let me know. Yeah. And let me know if it's consultants plus staff plus everything, or if there's other.
That's basically the consultant.
Just the consultant. So that's not the hiring of additional staff. Well, let me know what it comes out to be. I mean, this is the second presentation on this. I have no idea why we're doing it. I'm sorry. I just don't get it. Because it seems to me that every single water project that we have to do or we want to do then sits there for 10 years arguing with Fish and Wildlife, EIR, salt nutrient management. I mean, we just do plans after plans after plans. And then this seems to be another plan to analyze potential holes in those plans when really we're dictated to by the regulatory agencies who are going to approve this or that. I mean, you know, case in point, and, you know, this may be a generalization, but you look at the Santa Ana area that did all of this recycled water planning and then ended up being told no. So my thought, having worked for 30 years in regulation, is that I think we should spend more time and more energy lobbying on regulations and policies that are protective of what we need to do than trying to imagine every possible wind shift that's going to happen, whether it be water quality, government. I mean, the governor just announces, we're going to do this, or you have to do that. That can't be modeled. And, you know, I just don't know what looking at a bunch of hypotheticals that could not happen is going to do for us when, frankly, we don't do anything about the hypotheticals, right? I mean, we had some progress on the new drop, which is terrific, but I'd rather see us spend time on stuff like that than And you have no regulatory people on the stakeholder. Add regulatory people to that stakeholder group. Because, you know, I want to hear what Fish and Game thinks is going to be some big problem, or what tree people thinks is going to be the problem, because they're going to be the people that hold us up. It's not going to be the community members. It's going to be all of our hangups are going to come from other places. And I second presentation, I just do not know why we're doing this. And it's, I mean, I wrote down mumbo jumbo. We need to be about getting things done, not about pie in the sky stuff. And there's a lot of stuff that we know we need to get done, like the water treatment and the reservoirs. And I don't know why we're imagining other scenarios that could or could not happen when we can't even get done what we want to get done. It's just really frustrating to me. So in a frustrated mood tonight.
Dr. Colley. Not sure why Maria Goodside is telegraphing some of my concerns.
it's scary.
I think back, been on the board for 20 years. The first couple of years I've been on the board, we got a full study from Kennedy Jenks on exactly one of those slides on water reliability. And there was a policy set back then that 95% reliability, and as far as I know, that's still valid. I think we've said that a few times over the years. That study, I don't know what the budget was, certainly don't remember, but I'm sure we paid a lot of money for it. That particular study at that time was mathematical crap. The statistical analysis was fatally flawed, and I explained why and at the time. We've done others since. Each one of them, I think, cost a lot of money. And what I'm understanding, what little bit I was able to understand from the briefing here is that one slide is one little tiny slice of what we're trying to get to in this Mongo study that I too don't understand. I don't fully understand what we're, you know, I don't even understand that it can be modeled realistically. I don't see how that would be possible to create some kind of this pie in the sky dashboard. That I think I understand is we're going to have some pie in the sky dashboard that we can turn all these different knobs, and it's going to come out with some numerical number on what changed. There's nobody in this, nobody in the world is that smart to be able to come up with a numerical analysis of all of the different scenarios that could happen. It's accurate. It's going to be, at best, it's going to be, you know, just wild ass imagination that, oh, I think this will be, you know, something, and we put that in on top of these others. And yeah, I mean, you can build a mathematical model, but it won't have anything, won't be have any value in the end if it's just a whole bunch of guesses. So I'm trying to figure out what we're, this doesn't help me understand what we're paying for and what the value is. I can see looking at individual pieces of this, the reliability study. I mean, there's value in some of them that we've done. And there's value in some of the other studies we've done, but this one, I'm not sure. It seems like this, I don't know, overarching thing to study things which are probably unstudiable. That's just what I got out of the brief.
You had your hand up for a second, right?
Well, I'm not sure if Dirk wanted to.
Okay.
No. I've been in water business a long time. And when I got into the water business, it was very simple. And for many, many years, the water business has been reactive. You react to what's happening. You react to current circumstances. to what's happening in Spain. The water industry itself is becoming much more complex in trying to decide where you are and what's going to affect you in the future, and where you need to be, where you need to start investing your resources. And I see this as a huge opportunity for us to get out in front of that and have a better understanding of what we're what things are going to affect us in the future, and when do we expect those to happen, and how are we going to offset that? A lot of it comes down to dollars. I can guarantee a 95% reliability if you give me a big enough paycheck to go out and get water wherever we're at. We don't have that. And the easy, I don't want to say easy, because water resource management has never really been easy. But the easy part of water resource management, the years of those, and it's becoming very difficult, much more complex. And I think this is exactly where we need to be going in the future. I'm not going to belittle this thing in any manner. I think it's very important that we do this and get a better understanding of where we're going and what's going to affect us and where we need to be. So I'm all for this. I think this is a good opportunity.
For comment,
sure. So I was going to say the way I understood this work to be is that it helps us understand how our responses and combinations of responses and shifting of resources would address various scenarios. Is that, am I on track with that? Okay. So, I agree with Director Cooper. I feel like our future is becoming more and more uncertain. And I do think it is helpful to be prepared and know that, you know, a combination of these shifting of resources could help address if we get to, you know, this type of scenario in the future. Or maybe it's better if we shift and do this combination of resources to address this, you know. So I do think it's important to be forward thinking and not caught flat footed if we ever get to worse scenarios in the future. You know, I know there's the issue of cost and consultants, and that's something I constantly struggle with as a newer board member too, is understanding the balance of when is it appropriate to pay money out to consultants for work outside of the agency. And I feel like I'm still on that learning curve and understanding that. But in terms of the concept of this type of forward-thinking planning, I do think it's forward-thinking planning that's important for us as an agency who is in charge of making sure that our entire valley has water in what seems to be a more and more uncertain future. I think it could be a tool that we may need to rely on. That's my two cents at this point.
Can I phrase my concern as a question? Maybe it'll help me understand better. How does this relate to the reconnaissance study? Because I looked at the reconnaissance study as a forward-looking opportunity to let's look at all the different things that we could do. Right? Is this a next step in that? Is the reconnaissance study inform this? Is this trying to put numerical values on the how would they interrelate?
Do you mean reconnaissance study or reliability study?
No, the reconnaissance study is where we spent a lot of money. We spent a lot of money looking at all kinds of different possibilities to enhance our water, you know, so, you know, things like, you know, spreading water locally was studied, or
right.
there were
specific
specific things were looked at. You know, it's the reconnaissance study in my mind was, let's look at a pie in the sky, everything you could possibly do, and then begin to consider, you know, are these things practical? You know, would it work? Could you make it work? And so there was a study that had many different thoughts in it, as I recall. And so it sounds like those kinds of things would be, you know, scenarios A, B, and C on this.
Yeah, those would be considered adaptation.
Right.
Okay. Strategy. Yes. So
I do not see how this, I just don't understand how this works. I really don't. I mean, regulatory challenges, how do you map that? How do you put a number on that? How do you, and again, even if we have a number on it, is that number going to be valid? And then if that number is valid, what are we going to do about it? Because we just sit here, in my opinion, and take it when, you know, detection levels drop and we're told we have to turn wells off, or we're told that we can't use all of our recycled water that we were counting on, you know. I mean, and I think, yeah, we're not going to do anything about it. We're just going to be like worse and worse. And I mean, I just don't see how it helps us, because there's no correction for if the governor decides we need to serve distilled water. You know, I mean, there's not a correction for that. We could plant trees. We could tell everybody you can't take showers. But at some point, there's no correction for these things. And we don't do anything about that. So it just seems like, and also my other question is, why us? I mean, I understand that our basin has unique situations that may have to be, you know, plugged into a model, but this seems like something that would be a university work or Aqua. I mean, and is it going to do us any good if we say, well, we've modeled this? And again, if the regulators don't buy in, then they're going, nope, we don't like your numbers. We don't think that's right. We want you to do this other thing. I mean, it will just not result in a usable product.
Of this stuff. Come up with something that the regulators will or won't buy into. And the regulation is the risks that the agency faces. And so, what this process strives to do is to give you, the decision makers, an idea of if you have a certain path, if you have different strategies, and what's the possibility that you can. The meeting and road just if you would like to do something more uncertain approach, just give you an idea of. Okay, I'm wanting to cover 75% exceed level. This is the type of damage you will need to do that. Part of what this process drives for. It also, I think, very important in that it's going to start to advance our level of sophistication, knowledge, and engagement with the regulatory community, particularly when it comes to California Fishing Wildlife Service. Right now, we're in the status of type of letter that we got when we try to finalize our last recycled water master plan. Got a letter back saying, not enough information out there for us to make a decision. And that was the basis of Silver Springs successful lawsuit and said action has been identified. This process involves coming up with specific species and ecosystems. So we have a basis for having a discussion with the regulatory community. And we get to the point of wanting to permit new saugus wells or change the operating criteria and run our sustainability plan. And then have modeling that ties our offload model, groundwater model, new habitat suitability model. So we can start to quantify this change doesn't have an impact, or maybe there is an impact. We identify that, we can qualify and come up with a specific mitigation measure for that. To advance. And also strive to be able to allow the board to bear the Delta conveyance facilities will provide you a certain level of reliability. You still need a site reservoir. If you feel that you're doing any existing facility is a risk to a certain reservoir, what is that suite of adaptation strategies that you your liability, and how is that going to impact affordability?
So I'm going to pull an Ed here and say, well, that isn't going to help tonight. So, I mean, I think I personally need more discussion on it. I understand the module that you talked about. That makes sense. But layering module upon module upon module, and when I was talking about regulatory buy-in, you talk about species and stressors, that is going to come from the agency or from a lawsuit. I mean, we can talk about it now, but 20 years from now, somebody's going to have some other fish or some other tree or something else that we can't predict. So I just feel like those kind of answers might not be predictable. And if you do layer upon layer upon layer, especially without consulting the regulators or the people that might sue us, we might get data that's not helpful because it's not going to, we could say whatever we're going to say until they say, okay, we agree with you. It doesn't do us any good. And so I don't see the point. We're like predicting things that we can't predict. And I'm willing to talk about this offline some other time, but I haven't been sold on it.
The one thing that's always made this agency, I think, stand out from other water agencies is this agency has always had a very strong vision and has always done excellent planning. And there are agencies out there right now that are suffering terribly. Las Virgenes, some of them are in real bind because they haven't been there. And I think if we stop these kinds of things, that we become those kinds of agencies. Now, what all are we going to get out of this? I have absolutely no idea. None of us do. But I think it gives us a game plan of what are we going to need in the future and how are we going to respond to things. And if certain things happen, are we going to be able to
meet those needs and how much are we going to have to put into it to meet those needs. I think that's part of what this agency is all about, is that that good foresight and the planning that's out there in the future. So I'm all for doing this. I think it's important that we don't let it down and don't become reactive. If we become reactive and say, we're going to sit back and see what the other agencies do, then I think that puts us in a bad position.
Okay, so I want to agree with you absolutely that, you know, that not so much planning, but action. This agency has taken some really, you know, strong actions that, you know, buying double, then doubling our table A. Okay. I mean, that was a, when opportunity was seen, was recognized, you know, the folks that did that, you know, brilliant. Okay. Thank them every day. That wasn't a result of a study. That was a result of folks sitting at the board and being offered an opportunity and seeing it. And yeah, I think about the some number of years ago, we had that black box for developer fees, and nobody understood the black box. Right? Staff didn't understand it. Staff would say they didn't understand it. The black box said that we should do such and such and these, you know. And year after year after year, we just said the black box said. I'm wondering if this becomes this new black box, that the black box says, you know, we have this knob and we're turning this knob and out pops number, it's 83.5%. What? You know, I don't know. You know. So the individual things that you're talking about looking at, I understand, and we should be looking at them. I'm not, but I don't understand this process of, like, let's have, you know, let's go out and ask the community, you know, what would you like us to, you know, so, you know, I mean, it can be, you know, there are some folks in the community that come to our meetings all the time, and they suggest that we spend $100 million on putting, you know, a few gallons of recycled water over to the East End. Okay, now, I don't need to spend a lot of money getting that opinion. And I don't need to spend a lot of money studying it, because I pretty much know that spending millions of dollars to put a few gallons of water pumping into the East End makes, you know, doesn't enhance this valley's water reliability at all. Okay, we can just have a quick discussion over a beer and realize that's just not going to work. So I don't understand what the smart ideas that we've heard to talk about make sense to me. But this overarching, I don't understand.
I think a couple things that I'm hearing, if I can, Chair Ford. I mean, one, we need to educate more, right? Get more chance for input and understanding of what this initiative is trying to accomplish. So I'm hearing that, obviously. And that was the intent of the process, was to start regularly engaging, and Najwa showed you that tonight, right? So that we can deal with these things. And I'm hopeful that we will deal with them in sizes that we can all digest, right? And engage with and understand the kind of individual components. I think big picture on this, it's trying to take these individual things and incorporate them into a decision matrix that's helpful, right? So gone are the days of a single or a double bottom line. Those don't exist anymore, right? So you are dealing with things that are interrelated and multi-component, right? And so you can't look at, give you one example, you can't look at the groundwater basin as a groundwater level anymore. One simple example. When you look at a groundwater basin now, you have to look at the groundwater level. You have to look at the interaction between the surface water and the ground. You have to understand the environment that sits on top of there. Right? One example of what we're trying to understand and provide the board a ability to make sound policy decisions. So there's things that we can do with the groundwater basin that may impact those different things differently. And it's important to understand each of those components when you're trying to make those decisions. So we're not trying to make it overcomplicated. We're not trying to create something that is not understandable. We're actually trying to do the exact opposite of that. So I hear the concern of not understanding it.
Yes.
I get it. And so we will think about how we engage on these things in a way that I think you will all start to see value for. Our intent is to make sure we have as much regulatory certainty as we can, right? And it's a changing environment. It's dynamic. It doesn't stay stagnant, right? And so what we're trying to do is provide you all that get to make these really difficult policy decisions. We're getting ready to make significant investments, right? We're going to be asking to make generational investments. So you talk about these investments of the past, which had a lot of foresight. They took a lot of courage during those times, but it's a different time. You could make a decision on a devil's den and you didn't have to analyze, all these multiple bottom line impacts of that decision. It was a much simpler decision to make. We're trying to take a very complex decision and break it down in a way that is understandable so that you can make the best informed decision that you can. So that's what we're trying to achieve. I'm hearing that we're not understanding how the process is going to work to get to that point. So we will do, more of these sessions so that we can get recording where we hear your additional feedback and we can, make sure that we're incorporating that as we go along. I mean, you're going to see these things, they're coming as individual components, right? The CEF, all these approvals are going to come, right? These are contracts with consultants. So the CEF, I think, everybody understood the value of that profit.
It's the LIDAR thing.
Yeah, well, it's the LIDAR thing, but more importantly, it has functional flow analysis. Mm-hmm. So it gets after the question of how much water needs to be in the river.
If the Fish and Game agrees that functional flow is a valid figure.
Correct. That's an engagement process that will happen with them along the way as we develop.
They were not
the
stakeholder.
Yeah, I heard that.
Okay.
Obviously, they're on the stakeholder list. Okay. I mean, it's.
Oh.
So, yeah, they were sitting at the table, but I hear this was a tough presentation to have come up at. That's why I was trying to get to it. We're all a little wore out. I say that. So let's continue to understand. Well, if people want to reach out, Maria, if you have specific questions, happy to engage with that discussion. So
let me make just a real quick comment, because maybe as part of just understanding this briefing better, I hear the word model. Okay, and to me, a computer model is a thing that whole bunch of crap went into, and a computer, it comes out with a answer. Okay, what you just discussed is something to me very, very different. It's providing me, the decision maker, a whole bunch of data for me to then crank through, and for me to come up with what I think is the best policy decision. That's not a model. Okay, so maybe I'm having difficulty with the language. And if that's the case, then
I think we are going to use models, right? Because I think it will assist in the decision making, right? So, for instance, our reliability model, right? It models our operations. It operates our system as it exists today.
Right.
And we can add, for instance, a site's reservoir into that model. What does it do? Does it help us? Does it hurt us? How does it help us? You need a model to go through that exercise.
That's a good.
You're modeling over. We're very sophisticated in our modeling capabilities, right? So you're modeling a full hydrological record of the State Water Project, right? The whole sequence. And you're modeling the whole sequence of known kind of weather and things like that. Then we have to look at climate change. How do we incorporate climate change in that type of
model? Do we like?
Right. Well, and this, as Nadja was talking through, is going to look at different probabilities, different scenarios. So it helps you boil down. Climate change is extremely complicated to plan for, right?
Yep.
There are models that show more, less, in between. You know, this exercise is meant to try and digest some of that information. You know, will it be perfect? No. But it's going to be another tool that we have in our quiver when we're going through and trying to make these decisions. So, Director Colley, we are trying to make this very transparent. That is one of our main goals of this exercise, to try and make the tools transparent so that when we get to the decisions that we've got to make, these generational decisions, we have to make these. They're coming. And they're very large decisions. We want you all to be in a good position that you can make the best decision that you can for those. So, yes, some of it seems thorough and complicated, and maybe it's tough to digest right now, but we will do a better job of getting you all up to speed with that as we go.
So we'll see this tomorrow. Thank you.
Sounds good. Don't make it October 12th. The night's filled. Ms. Miltimeyer, you submitted a comment card after the item has been heard.
So you can let me speak.
I will let you speak this time, but in the future, no. Yeah.
Right. Yes, we have been including here. And you don't explain to the public how much this wonderful idea that they have, that it's costing us the ratepayers. Didn't hear it mentioned, man. Nobody asked any of you.
But I remember we talked about
six. How much will it cost?
I did actually ask.
Yeah, I specifically heard that question. And okay.
Well, I didn't hear how much it's costing the rate.